Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you want to go to rugby heaven? Let's go back to 1987 with Squidge, with Squidge. Let's go back to 87 with Squidge.
Hello and welcome to the Squidge Rugby World Cup Retrospective, right? The rugby podcast that, for the first time in 27 episodes, has a good game of rugby to talk about.
I wouldn't say the first time, but it's certainly one of.
Ooh, I don't know. I think you can make an argument for Romania-Zimbabwe.
That was a bit of a banger.
Throughout the, I think right back to those Lions episodes, right? I don't think we've talked about a genuinely good game of rugby until now.
Yeah, I mean,
look through the past episodes. I'd say Romania-Zimbabwe is the only one I'll stand up for what, in any way, shape, or form.
What I will say is we have definitely been on a losing streak recently. We have several episodes in a row opened the episode by saying, oh, why do we do this again? Oh, yeah, it's bloody, you know, this Squidge thing that we're doing. It's so dumb, isn't it? We're just covering games no one cares about. Whereas now it's like, oh, yeah, this was good. I enjoyed this.
Okay. I'm just skimming through the episodes, right?
Yeah.
I think you can make a case for Scotland 20, France 20.
Yeah, that was good.
Jamie Lyle.
That was good.
I think you can make an argument for that one being good.
I mean, there was shit aspects to it.
Zimbabwe, as I say, was all right.
Yeah.
That was a pretty good game. Other than that, I am looking back through these, and every single game was shite. Maybe Canada-Ireland? Maybe Canada-Ireland was okay?
There was the late dramatic drop goals.
The game was bad, and then Canada scored about 18 drop goals at the end.
It was 18,000 drop goals. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think there's something in, I guess, Canada-Ireland. But also, it wasn't a good quality game, just Canada.
You know what?
We're a bit
I'm now going through everything. I think all of the games I've enjoyed the most have been all of the games with France.
Yeah, okay. And they haven't necessarily been good games.
No.
They've just been games.
Like, they've been entertaining against Zimbabwe, USA, France, no, Scotland even, even though that one was a draw.
They were great against France.
Yes.
France always play well against France
in
World Cups.
They do. They tend to. I mean, there's probably a genuine joke to be made about that. But yeah, I mean, I guess you're right that either way, we are struggling.
This is kind of the hubris we've had. We're paying off covering the second Lions test from 2009.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't a World Cup game, so we covered one of the greatest games of all time. And then, instead, like, in response, we've been cursed with endless shite.
We had a streak whereby we were watching the two World Cup semi-finals after the quarterfinals from 2011, right?
Yeah.
That's probably three or four, to guess, of the best games of rugby that the two of us have ever experienced. And then we had, the second and third Lions test, right? And we were probably quite burned out from all of that, thinking like, oh, I can't wait to do games that have nothing on them. And now it's kind of the inverse.
Yeah, I mean, when we get to the next World Cup, it's going to be, I mean,
However,
we are getting closer because this is the last game of the pool stage we're now on.
How mental
Australia
is that?
Against Japan. We've
That's
somehow
crazy.
Made it through. We've now seen. How do you feel having seen? Oh, you're Will Owen, by the way, and I'm like.
Oh, shit, yeah, I am. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah, I am Will Owen.
Yeah, congratulations. You have now seen every pool game from the 1987 Rugby World Cup.
Just about.
How do you feel?
I don't know. It's like, I was going to say it's cool that I've done it. I don't know if it is.
Yeah, I get that. I feel that.
Like, we've spoken a lot of times before about the fact that one day we'll have completed this podcast and we'll be able to say, like, oh yeah, we've watched every game to ever happen in the World Cup, and that would be so cool. Mm. But I kind of realise now, we're actually talking about it publicly, it's not really, is it?
From our perspective, it is, right?
It's okay, like, yeah.
You know, it's like, is it cool that I've seen, like, 40 Woody Allen movies? No,
sure.
It isn't, because Woody Allen is a nonce.
Yeah.
But for a period when I was 19 and I hadn't read up on the allegations against him properly, I was like, well, it's kind of cool. I've almost seen all of them, and one day I'll see all of them, and I definitely won't desperately regret the sheer amount of Woody Allen movies I'm consuming now. And the fact that if I check my letterbox now, he'd still have like twice any other director when you went to like most watched filmmakers.
Yeah, that is a shame. That's aged quite badly.
Yeah. But... And here's the thing. This Rugby World Cup's also aged quite badly.
Yeah, but not in the same way Woody Allen has. I think that's a pretty unfair comparison, mate. Like,
no, I know. But, I mean, the creator of Woody Allen never talks about one of the shag pigeons. So...
It's very true. Yeah. Unless the
I'm not going to keep standing up for Woody Allen. I'm sorry. I don't want to. Yeah. I'm not going to do that.
Unless the creator of the Rugby World Cup was Woody Allen Sr. But I don't think
that's
it was.
True.
So
that's true.
We're not going to stretch this bit out.
No, we're not. Instead, we're going to talk about rugby. So, as I say, the game today is Australia 42, Japan 23, right? But the game is much tighter and much closer than that makes it sound.
Yeah. So, once again, this game is uploaded onto the Uncle Boon Me Who Can Recall Past Rugby World Cups YouTube channel.
Yep.
But I say the game is... Probably about three quarters of the game is. I don't know. I think we're maybe missing actually probably the last 2 minutes or something. But we missed one try on the end, which canonically didn't happen. So
yeah, so we were in the office this afternoon, and whilst editing the All Blacks Ireland video, I was kind of scrambling alongside trying to find a copy of this game. And I managed to get hold of it. We managed to get it.
And well done.
Didn't realise until we were watching it back that that I was missing a large part of it. And I apologise.
I don't think it was a large part of it, to be fair.
And to... No, I think it's probably about 5 minutes.
Yeah, maximum.
So, we're missing one Australia try at the end.
And yeah.
Otherwise,
there was a point...
Otherwise, it...
There was a point where the commentary said there's 13 minutes left, and I checked, and there was 11 minutes left. So, do the math.
Oh, okay, that's fine. Then.
But, okay. Yeah. Two. The thing is, like, look, whoever scored the last try at the end, I'm not really sure who it was. It's your fault. You should have scored that earlier.
Yeah,
players should plan for the stream cutting out.
Yes. I believe the final try is scored by Mark Hartill, the tight head.
Oh, okay.
Right at the end. So I'm imagining it's probably a terrible try, but we have no way of knowing.
Look, there was one try that happened earlier in the game. Because I've got the try scorers in front of me. But there was a try that happened earlier in the game where I just, like, basically didn't notice it happen. Because I was busy. I was literally watching it in the rugby club clubhouse, putting my boots on, ready to coach. Whilst I had the stream sat next to me. Because I've had a very busy day, as you know.
Yeah.
And watching that game was something I was doing as a multitask. And that one try was the one bit where the other part of my brain didn't prioritise it. But it was a shit try anyway, which we'll come to. But, yeah. So, with that in mind, actually. So, there was a game a few weeks back where you didn't have any notes because you went to Worcester.
Yes.
So, at this time...
They
don't allow notebooks in Worcester, so which
really
is a real
weird,
pain
like,
in the arse.
Really weird, like, medieval law.
It
that's
is,
not
yeah.
allowed. Like, you walk into WH Smith's and it's mostly empty.
Yeah. It's just, like, really overpriced meal deals in there. Like, that's all there is.
Yeah, that's it. And like, old magazines.
Yeah. If
you've got a choice between an egg sandwich and a copy of Edge.
Yeah. I remember in Worcester, actually, there was the left-handed shop is in Worcester that you
it's
used to go
anymore.
To. When I was, is it not? That's gutting.
So I went. I looked for it the last time I was there for the Premier 15 final because we used to go there a lot as kids.
Yeah. And I'm left-handed, so the left-handed shop was like Legoland for me.
Because I'm kind of the black horse of the family, back sheep of the family. I'm the black horse of the family.
Black horse.
Because you don't think I'm going to win. I'm the black sheep of the family in that I am right-handed. In a and there was a lot of like left-handed goings on in the Owens.
Yeah. But you know, now I'm outnumbered because our father left us, and he was left-handed. So
yeah.
So
maybe that was
you've won the war.
Do you think that's where he got the idea? He looked at which hand he preferred. He went left. Okay, I'll have left.
Nice. That was
turns
genuinely
out
a good
turns
joke.
Out the shop went bankrupt during COVID. And it wasn't there
oh,
anymore,
no.
which was a shame.
Oh, yeah, because those people became right-handed over COVID.
It was one of the symptoms. People didn't realise it for a really long time.
Yeah.
It's like how, you know, I knew someone who was like, have you ever known someone that lost their sense of smell before? Because I've lost my sense of smell. Didn't realise until like 2 years later. I was like, oh, yeah, I clearly had COVID early.
Not,
it's like
see,
that. Like, lots of people just got right-handed.
Do you want to hear a really good joke that people make about coronavirus?
Sure.
You won't have heard this one before, actually. It's a completely original joke that I heard recently and thought, oh, okay, two things about this. Oh, I don't know what punchline is about to come. And also, like, oh, I've never heard that one before. Okay, can you just pretend to me that you like Coldplay?
Hello.
Hi there.
William.
Hi there, Robbie.
I am a fan of the popular hit beat combo Coldplay.
Oh, Coldplay, I'm aware of that. Wait a second. Do you like them?
I quite like the Coldplay. I enjoy many of their top hits, such as Yellow.
That's a Coldplay song.
And Adventure of a Lifetime.
Yeah, that's also a Coldplay song. But wait a minute. You like that song? Do you have coronavirus? Because one of the symptoms is that you have no taste. That's a joke.
Genuinely haven't heard that.
I've heard that joke ridiculous amounts of times because I have no taste, personally. Like, lots of people make that joke about me. Coldplay are fine.
Yeah, they're fine. You know, they do the job, don't they? And they wrote a song about Morgan Parra, which I'm all for. Rhiannon will hate it, but...
Yeah, that's very true. Look, Coldplay and Marmite are two things that you should either love or hate. I think they're both fine.
Yeah. Just ambivalent towards Marmite, which is going to be the name of... That's my favourite Half Man Half Biscuit album.
You know what? I like Coldplay. I don't love them. I think they're good.
Hey, have you got coronavirus?
No, why do you ask?
You've got no taste.
What?
So, you might not have taste, but do you know what this game from 1987 had?
What?
It had two teams.
Okay.
And so, we're going to move on to look at the teams.
Okay. Wait, I didn't tell the story, but
what was your story?
I didn't mention why I brought up Worcester and the left-handed shop. That was because you went there the other week and you didn't have any notes.
Oh, yeah!
Whereas this time, neither of us had notes because we spontaneously, separately started watching this game when we'd finished the Ireland video. So I had to make all of my notes on my phone and you've had to make it in like a Google Doc or something, right?
Yeah, I've made my notes on Google Doc, so I've got them. Like, I don't have notes that exist. I don't actually have notes this week. Because I wasn't in Worcester, which is the real pain in the neck.
Yeah. You're not even allowed notes in Worcester. Like, your notes app just locks while you're in Worcester.
Ashley Beck has been furious. He hasn't been able to remember anything. Like, every time he goes to the shop, he's got no idea what his shopping is now. Like, he normally used to make a list. And now he's just like, what do I buy? Do I buy cheese?
Yeah.
As he wanders around that Tesco next to the train station. I've been to Worcester. I know the Tesco's next to the train station. I remember a great player spotted on Blood and Mud, the podcast that everyone listening to this also listens to.
Yes.
Where someone spotted Francois Hugo in Waitrose in Worcester. And you know what? I walked past the Waitrose in Worcester while I was there, and I looked through the window just to see if I could spot him, even though he no longer plays for Worcester.
It would have been exceptional if you saw at least a rugby player there. Because, like, you sampled the delights of Waitrose and Worcester just in case Francois Hohart was there. And you looked at it with Francois Hohart in mind, but...
The previous time I'd been in Worcester, before the Premier League's final, because I seem to find myself in Worcester a lot, I sat in a pub to do some work, to just, like, I had my laptop out, and it was, like, the most convenient place.
Were you making
notes?
During
COVID, like, a lot of people weren't around. No, I want to be very clear on that. I wasn't making any notes. I was only writing whole sentences, which is the distinction. Okay. And
I would have to edit that out so the police don't get us.
Like... Yeah. No. The Worcester police, they're very, very forceful.
I'm shaking.
And I overheard there was a conversation going on between two old men who were talking about how shit Paul Hodgson was.
They're not wrong.
Like, one of them was talking about, like, scrum halves or something, and everyone was like, do you remember that lad Paul... I don't know why they've got a northern accent, they're from Worcester. So, do you remember that Paul Hodgson? It was like one of the biggest waste of money we've ever spent. And then they started, like, describing one time he got charged down playing for Worcester. in like in detail up against Bath. It was great because like you very rarely hear conversations like that in the East Midlands.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Like
I remember once when I was on the way back from Birmingham after going to a gig, and I was on the train there, and I did have my headphones in. I was listening to music or a podcast or whatever, or something else you could listen to in headphones. And then I heard behind me... No, that was it. I was watching a Red Roses game against Ireland from the Six Nations on really shit train Wi-Fi. And then I heard the people behind me, I heard the name Handro Liebenberg come into conversation. I was like, hang on, I just need to eavesdrop here. So I just turned the commentary like very far down. And I was just eavesdropping on these two Tigers fans talking about their chances for the rest of the season. And you know what? They said they were going to win the Prem, and they did. They didn't say a Freddie Burns drop goal, but yeah, and I really enjoyed eavesdropping on that conversation. I really wanted to like turn around and say like, you know what? Tommy Rafael's really good, isn't he?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I didn't.
It happened during, I mean, it was on the way back from the Premiership final, but like, I was doing that of eavesdropping on some Tigers fans who just won the Premiership and were delighted about it. And then they recognised me and joined in. And they were great lads.
Oh, nice.
I wish I asked for their names. They were lovely.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, there was a...
Big up those lads.
This, honestly, the best thing about minor levels of fame is every now and again getting to join in when people are talking about
Tommy Rafael. Like, acceptably eavesdropping on trains.
Yeah. It's lovely. Otherwise, you don't get to have enough conversations about Marley Packer.
Exactly, yeah. But yes, you were saying we have two teams here.
Two teams. Should we start with the Australia team?
Okay, let's do that. So I think that they make quite a lot of changes for this game. The most fun of the changes is that they move David Campese to fullback.
Yes.
Which is, let me tell you, I don't use these words very lightly. It's a really strong phrase. It's a right laugh.
It is. It's just the correct decision for entirely neutral reasons.
Yep.
Although we do have the very sad news that Pap Daddy himself, Brett Papworth, drops the bench.
He does.
In order to bring in Michael Cook, who was talked up as like a very, very good player at the time, but had been kind of struggling with injuries coming into this World Cup. He would go on after this to go to rugby league, as with the entire Australian team, played 1 year after this World Cup for the Wallabies before going to rugby league.
Of course.
And yeah, so he'd played for the Wallabies against France the previous year, had apparently been just outstanding, played kind of like just played consistently for them, then right before the World Cup got injured. Then, spoilers, goes on to break his arm during this game.
Oh, yeah, of course. And Pap Daddy does actually get his appearance in the end.
Pap Daddy gets
on. We do get to see him a little
bit. He currently works as a PE teacher.
Oh, Michael Cook.
Michael Cook.
Huh. That's pretty cool, I guess. Especially to say, I assume he's probably like in his 60s or something. So, you know, good to see that he's still cutting about doing his thing.
Yep. I'll tell you what, right? Not only is he a PE teacher, he was the PE teacher of Daniel and Anthony Herbert and Brendan McKibben.
Oh, no way.
Play for the Waratahs.
Yeah. Brendan McKibben did play for London Irish, though, so that's not as good.
Okay.
But still, Brendan McKibben was a player.
And it gets better. Ben and Alex Toulis as well.
Oh, wow.
Also came through his school.
I forgot they were Australian.
Yeah.
So he has coached an international.
Yeah.
Taught.
Yes, or at least he was still teaching there in 2015. And I think
the school's going to take credit for that.
Retired now. So yeah, so, you know, good chance he coached or taught Ben Toulis, future Scotland international.
Indeed. So in the pack, they bring in a lot of unfamiliar names. They bring in Mark McBain at hooker, Mark Hartill, who we mentioned earlier, a tight end prop, Ross Reynolds in the second row.
Yeah.
Yeah, a few names that we've not really seen or heard much of thus far in the tournament.
Yeah. So it's a largely changed pack, even if the back line is largely, other than, you know, I say one player coming back from injury and David Campese moving to fullback, largely the same. A lot of them are quite well-established Wallabies as well. A lot of them have won caps and been playing for them for a few years.
Yeah. Like, there's a point, like, probably 10 minutes from the end of the game, or as far as I'm aware, where Gordon Bray says on the commentary, like, oh, how amazing has Mark McBain been all this time? Like, you know, you ask anybody, they'll just say Mark McBain has been one of the best players. And I was just thinking, like, who the hell is Mark McBain? I've never, like, heard of him. Like, I've not seen him yet in this game. But that's probably on me.
No, I think, looking back on it, he had a solid game for a hooker in 1987, which is an impossible thing to...
I loved his throwing in style. He was like a cricket bowler. Like, he would have it, like...
He bends the ball, like, halfway across his back. And he lobs it.
I don't think
he threw it straight once, like, but... Phew.
But, like, he basically has it so it doesn't put any spin on it or anything. He has it so it basically goes... It goes perfectly still through the air. It doesn't move whatsoever. It's a really strange technique, but I loved it.
It's bizarre. It looks so uncorrect to the eye. Almost as uncorrect as that word sounded.
Yes.
Do you want to hear something else incorrect?
Yeah.
So, right, we have, in this game, captaining Australia for the first time, is Simon Poidvin, right?
Yes.
In this game, Simon Poidvin also breaks the record to become the most capped Australian of all time, up until that point.
Yes, indeed.
This is, I believe, his 43rd cap.
Yeah.
Which at the time was a hell of a lot.
Yeah,
though I suppose we've seen, like, and actually, won 50 caps, and it does happen, you get high numbers.
Sure, yeah. And, like, in fairness, like, throughout this tournament, I think Poidvin has been one of those kind of consistent present members in their pack that we're probably not giving enough credit.
Yeah. So I naturally, I hadn't paid much attention to him, and he's weirdly, when you look at kind of his achievements, right, so he's one of only four Australian players ever to have won both a Grand Slam, beating all four, you know, British-Irish teams, beating the four home nations, to have achieved a series victory in New Zealand and won a World Cup, right? Only four players have ever done that, and he's one of them.
Fair play.
So those the other players, David Campese, Michael Leiner, Nick Farr-Jones, right?
Right, all okay, of those so are all
kind of talked about as all-time greats, right?
Yeah.
You never hear his name. You never
No,
hear
I
Simon
didn't know
Poidvin's
who he was
name.
Before we started this podcast. But as I say, I've been impressed by him.
Yeah. And, yeah, this was kind of like a big day for him when he became captain of the Wallabies for the first time. As well as, say, you know, 43 caps of his eventual 59, which he retired with, becoming a, you know, big part of the thing. Yeah, he then kind of retired from international rugby. Oh, no, he plays in the 91 World Cup, but he misses a lot of the next few years injured before making it to the 91 World Cup and winning the World Cup, then retiring.
Right, yeah.
However, right, after retiring, he seems to go into a few different things. One of them is seemingly updating his Wikipedia page, because he has the most complete and most detailed Wikipedia page I've ever seen on a rugby player. Like, genuinely, I reckon it's longer and more detailed than, like, Brian O'Driscoll or Dan Carter's. Like, it's absurd.
We could make a 15 of players editing their Wikipedia pages at this point.
Yep. So, okay, so I want to tell you about this, right? The early life section of his Wikipedia page, which if you look at almost any other rugby player, right, is a paragraph at most, if they've got one.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of goes,
it's
they were
basically
raised in
like,
this environment.
Yeah, Paul went to this school, he played for this rugby club, yeah, his dad took him down, he has a sister called Jenny, you know.
Yeah. Okay, for reference's sake, for comparison's sake, right, I'm going to check this against Brian O'Driscoll's Wikipedia page, okay, as the... Possibly the most celebrated player of all time.
Yeah, one I think that's other, not an me. Unfair...
I think he's up there with Richie McCaw, Dan Carter, Brian.
And Johnny Wilkinson.
Probably looking at those three.
Yeah,
Johnny Wilkinson, Gareth Edwards. Right, there you are.
John Lomu.
John Lomu. Yeah. Okay, we can keep listing them. I'm going for O'Driscoll for argument's sake, okay?
Yes.
O'Driscoll's early life section on his Wikipedia page is three paragraphs long, okay?
Okay, that's long.
Poidvin's is nine.
What the fuck?
So, Brian O'Driscoll's, I'm going to summarise it, basically says, these are his parents, his dad was pretty good, and his uncle won four caps for Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
His father was good at rugby, his uncle was good at rugby. As a child, he played Gaelic football a bit, before focusing entirely on rugby. He then played with Gordon Darcy for Ireland schools, and then played for the Ireland under-19s and Leinster under-19s before moving up there. Right? Okay. Also
yeah, that makes
sense. Fly-off position to centre. That makes sense. That covers his early rugby career there, right?
Yeah.
So, by the time you get to Poidvin being born, there's more detail and more words than there is in Brian O'Driscoll's entire section.
For like,
so it mentions
his mother's pregnancy.
Like, First sentence mentions the hospital he's born in, his mother's maiden name, his father. Then the first of five siblings, it tells you in detail about each of his siblings.
Okay.
It tells you about his surname, the origin of his surname, which comes from a French sailor who'd been imprisoned by the English in the 1820s and eventually settled in Australia and took an Irish wife. It describes in detail the farm he grew up on. But, you know, the size of the farm is 360 hectares. Where it is, the list of animals they kept. It then goes into his family, right? So his grandfather on his mother's side, Les Hannon, played for Australia in 1908, sorry, which is interesting. That's fine. That works. That's grand. Then goes on to say he fought in World War One in the 1st Light Horse Brigade, starts to detail his career as a stretcher bearer. It then goes into Poydevin's father's cousin, Dr. Leslie Oswald Poydevin, was an accomplished cricketer, and then has a paragraph on his career stats. Right? So I can tell you that he had 151 for New South Wales against McLaren's MCC side during the 1918 season.
And let's be honest, Poydevin probably never met him.
Yep. Then goes on to tell us about his other cousin, his father's other cousin, who was an accomplished tennis player. While studying medicine, won the Swiss Championship in the Davis Cup, right? And then, Poydevin's older brother, right, who also represented New South Wales schoolboys at rugby union. He played flanker as well, grand, lovely stuff. At first, he then talks about his school, then talks about his kind of rugby league background, and then talks about moving to rugby union when going to college, talks about his time at college for a while, and then moves on to him starting to play union fully, then talks about his degree, then talks about making the university's first team, moving to Randwick, home of the Eller brothers and many other Wallabies. That's where it ends. Then starts his Wikipedia is rugby union career section, right?
Okay.
Which, again, so Brian O'Driscoll's Wikipedia has 9 paragraphs on his club career, right?
Which
Simon Poydevin.
You know what? By Brian O'Driscoll, literally Brian O'Driscoll, like, he did a lot in his club career, you know?
Simon, do you know what? I'm just going to split, because they've divided it by years, and Wesley O'Driscoll is divided by Club International, right?
Okay.
I am going to scroll at a consistent pace for O'Driscoll's and then for Simon Poydevin's rather than counting the paragraphs, okay? And I'll tell you when I'm done, okay? I'm starting at the top of Brian O'Driscoll's section on his rugby union career, okay?
Right.
I'm done.
Okay.
Okay. That's covered his appearance at the Barbarians, his time with British and Irish Lions, his games for Leinster, his all 100-plus caps, and his time at Leinster, right?
I would make that roughly 4.5 seconds.
Okay. I am now going to start on Simon Poydevin's Wikipedia page on his rugby career and scroll at exactly the same pace as best I can, okay?
Okay.
Starting now. We're not even up to the World Cup yet.
Jesus Christ. What?
He's got another 5 years of it. Here we are, it's the World Cup. Okay, we're still going. Okay. Okay, done.
Jesus Christ. I make that just short of 30 seconds.
Yep. Okay, so it's absurdly long, his Wikipedia page. And why I spent so long on it.
What
it's
did he
absolutely
do?
Absolutely ridiculous. It talks through almost every game he ever played, seemingly. It talks through every individual campaign, how his teams got on, how he played in each game. It talks through the whole thing. It gives, very detailed references. There's references to his autobiography repeatedly, which every time it lists by name, which I'll come back to the name of the autobiography. You know, that this is going to be relevant later.
Okay.
It talks about his favourite games he played in detail. His favourite game he ever played in was the semi-final against France in this World Cup, which is coming up.
Okay.
Which we will have a hopefully quite exciting guest when we get there.
Hmm, yes.
However, after about a billion noteworthy things in his rugby career, right?
Yeah.
Simon Poydevin retires from rugby. He works briefly as a commentator for a few years before focusing on his financial career. Okay?
Okay.
So, he goes on
He's working with money, right?
He is working with money. Okay.
With the great AUS dollar.
Yes. the bear in mind that amateurism is the greatest force for good in the world.
Indeed.
He's now working entirely in amateurism to entirely with money.
He's gone from being one of the best people in the world with such good forces, amateurism. And he's betrayed the owner of Rugby World Cup Limited who wanks over pigeons. He's betrayed that man by going and working with money.
So he initially becomes a stockbroker right after time from the Wallabies. Okay? He goes on to become managing director of equity sales at Citigroup in Australia, who are a big financial company who do money. Mm-hmm. Or the big American company who was head of their Australian branch, right?
Imagine getting money.
I know. He then goes and becomes executive directors at various different companies, one of them called Dart Energy, which, great, etc. However, he then goes and joins the board of a company called Diversa Limited, okay?
Okay.
And then joins Bell... Actually, that's not relevant, but that's fine. He then joins a company called Bell Potter Financial Group as managing director corporate stockbroker, right? He's really...
So you're saying all of this is relevant?
This bit is. So, right? In November 2017, he was banned from providing financial services for 5 years. So his ban is up in November.
Right? By World Rugby,
so
right?
I have, this evening, been reading through what he did. And essentially, I can boil it down to, he was using him and a client he was working with.
Okay.
Were essentially propping up the price of a company they're investing in artificially in order to kind of inflate the price. And then, sell stocks down the line. There was kind of like lots of financial misgivings going on. Okay?
Did he work for Vuno Prop? Client bloody Nigel Ray?
I'll tell you what, right? He was trying to make all the money in the world. He was trying to artificially create all the money in the world.
So basically... This guy, Simon Poitevin, won everything there is to win in rugby. Then he went, you know what? Success completed it. What I need now? Money. Right? And then he essentially just worked at that for like bloody 30 years or whatever. And then went, okay, I've had enough of this. Let's print money, baby.
He was forced to pay a penalty of... $358,000.
Serves him right for earning the fuckers.
Yep. So he's currently still banned from all kinds of financial doings.
Wow. He needs to stop
and also from speaking to some people. Yeah, he should go back to it. Add some more pages to the Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
However, do you want to know the title of his autobiography?
I do now.
For Love, Not Money. How desperately ironic that the guy that gets banned for financial misgivings is the guy who names his autobiography about how he hates money.
When was said autobiography released?
I do not know that.
Fair enough.
I can look this up right now, seamlessly, without anyone knowing.
Honestly, mate, I know I never wanted to do any money. Never wanted it.
Well, you can't get fined.
It was published in 1990.
Okay.
Published in 1990, before he retired.
Wow, interesting. And before he went into finance.
So, hold on. Before he retired, he published a book.
Okay.
So that he could make money off it, presumably.
This guy does not want to be poor.
I'm seeing a theme.
Yeah.
I'm seeing a theme here.
Guy likes money. I'm getting the impression.
Book has 3.6 on Goodreads. But no one has reviewed it.
Okay. Look, we've several times, long after the joke is dead, referred back to all the money in the world. But...
Wait. It's not like us to ham on a joke long after it's dead.
Right? But I feel like we know where it is in the present day. But I feel like we're getting a very, very good reading into what happened somewhere in between all of that happening. Mm-hmm. And look, we'll find out more when we get onto the 91 and 95 and 99 World Cups and so on. But I get the feeling Simon Poitevin's got quite a lot of money.
I think so. I think he might have begun the snowballing that would one day create all the money in the world.
Yeah. It somehow ends up in Andy Gomesall's pocket.
And no one knows how it gets there.
No one knows how it gets
but
there.
But one day when we cover 2007,
yes,
we might be able to work that
out. Who knows? Watch this space.
One final note on Poidevin. So Andrew Slack, who's the Australian captain for this World Cup, was playing in this game and just chose to give Poidevin the captaincy.
Okay.
Because it was his record-breaking cap.
Oh, that's quite nice, actually.
Good on you.
I rate that.
Which, yeah, I think is like an anti-Dick of the Day nomination. It's like he gets immunity from Dick of the Day.
Yeah, yeah, like he gets a point in the plus category. I rate that. Good on Andrew Slack. What a good lad.
Yeah. We've got to cut him some.
He gets good lad points.
Got to cut him some Andrew. Cut him some Andrew.
Very good. Very good. Should we look at the Japan team?
Let's look at the Japan team.
So they make a couple of changes. They bring in Sonali Tuilatu at number 8. They bring on, and I did not realise until just now that this was his debut, but on the left wing they bring on Minoru Okadoi, who I was not familiar with, but he has an interesting game, and we'll come on to the many things he does in this game, but the fact that it's his debut definitely puts it in a lot of context for me.
That does change an awful lot. I did not realise that, and now I am utterly fascinated by him.
Me too.
This was the first of 4 caps all this year. He plays in all of Japan's games after this during the rest of 87, and doesn't play for them again.
Okay, fair enough.
He goes on to play for them in an exhibition game against the All Blacks.
Right, okay.
In Tokyo at the end of this year.
Fair enough, yeah. So they keep in sort of the star players. There's the Fujitas, the Hayashis of the world, Miyamoto. There's a lot of players that we've kind of, I would say we've grown quite fond of. Obviously, we'll get to the Japanese leaving party later. But yeah, there's a lot of those sort of players that they've kept in for one last hurrah in this Rugby World Cup.
Yeah, I think so. As you say, it's kind of, they know this is their last shot. Yeah. They know this is their last game. They can't go through at this point. They're done. But they can still leave with a bit of a party. They can still make their mark on the
tournament. They can still have banter, you know?
Exactly.
Which is exactly what they do.
Yep. Yoshinaga comes in at 13 as well, who I thought was fun.
Mm.
Surprisingly big hitter for a man his size.
Yeah. There's a couple of times where, like, I don't know if he did it deliberately, but he, like, ended overlaps by making big hits. And, like, he was playing against Andrew Slack, who is an agile player.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, he is a disproportionately physical guy. Mm.
Yeah, no, no.
Because he doesn't look that big. Like, at one point in commentary, Gordon Bray says about how small the Japanese team are.
Yeah.
Some have been saying that they should be wearing platform heels. To which the other commentator says, or elevated shoes, which is the opposite of banter.
Yeah, oh, God. Mark Eller drove
bringing the joke down to
be
nothing. Is it Mark Eller again? Yes. Of course it's Mark Eller. Okay.
Like, the first thing I have written on my notes is, oh, God, it's Mark Eller again on Japan after the racist remarks he made last time.
I want to make one last note on, because we're not going to talk about it again, Toshiyuki Hayashi, right?
Yeah.
Who's playing prop, also played lock during his career, which I think is interesting.
I like that.
And, played both. He was the first ever non-British player to play for Oxford in the varsity match.
Oh, nice. That's good. He's really good, actually, Hayashi, captain, of course.
Oh, sorry. Okay, he was the first Japanese player to achieve it, and the second non-British player after David Kirk.
Oh, wow. That's very cool. I like that a lot.
He also became, a few years later in 1992, the first Japanese player to play for the Barbarians.
Oh, nice. You know what?
So he has
thoroughly deserved.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of time for this guy.
Quite a nice kind of story of just kind of stumbling through breaking records and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd go on to, you know, captain Japan for quite a long time. He captains them. Actually, does he captain this game?
Yes, he does, yeah.
Yeah. Captain them for quite a few years, for the next kind of 4 years as well, after the off the back of this.
Yeah.
And he also now runs a charity.
Oh, that's cool. I got really good vibes from him, actually, like, throughout the whole tournament. Like, I know we've made a lot of jokes about the weird way he wears his scrum cap, but
yeah,
I've got good vibes every single game I've seen him play. Like, I've enjoyed him.
So I have one thing I haven't yet, because I only came across this, like, right before we started recording.
Okay, yeah.
I came across this whilst I was on the toilet before we started recording as an emergency thing, which is a lovely image for all the listeners out
yes.
there. So,
yeah, we all do it.
The Gospelers, who are a Japanese band, a Japanese group from the mid-90s,
okay.
dedicated the song to him.
Oh!
They wrote a song about him that I want to try and find for the Leaving Party.
Yes.
I haven't had a chance to look this up, but I will when we get there.
We have to try and find that. That's brilliant. I'm so excited to hear that. Not enough songs are about Japanese international rugby players, I don't think. It's the one thing Coldplay lack.
Absolutely. You know, where is it?
All
taste.
These songs that are just named after emojis. Like, no, just name them after Japanese rugby players instead, you know?
I found it.
Okay,
we are listening to
this later on. And I feel like in that party, we'll have to have a little bit where we actually do listen to it.
Yeah.
That's great. I'm so excited to hear this. And pull the lyrics up as well and see if we can translate
them. Yeah, I've got some of the lyrics are in English.
Brilliant.
And I'm going to translate
that's so exciting. We'll get to this later, but that's really good. That's something to look forward to. Should we look at the game?
Yes, let's. Because as I say, this is actually
this
good
is
game.
A banger.
This is a really
this
fun
is a
game.
Banger. Like
this is the most fun I've had of a game in this World Cup for over the whole tournament.
Yeah.
First half in particular. The first half is fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to watch a game and genuinely enjoy it, while still getting a sense for the fact that some of the rugby is crap often.
Of course.
This is the one to go for. Yeah. Because it's back and forth, it's exciting. It's the kind of thing that people imagine when they think of, you know, older rugby, because they only see the highlights compilations.
Yeah. And, like, there are really good moments in it that... And again, sometimes the moments are good because they're shit, but, like, they're so enjoyable. The whole game, like, I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed
before
it.
Before we start off, before the game actually kicks off,
yeah,
we have Gordon Bray on comms.
Yes.
Says, the referee today is Jim Fleming of Scotland.
Yes.
Assisted by Brian Anderson and Mr. McNeil.
Like, he's a Mr. Man.
Like, I was saying, like, he's a character from children's television. I was thinking more like Balamori or something. Like, he's a magical man in a hat who runs a tent where you can go and find a magical squid.
At first, I had to, like, double check, like, should that not be, like, Professor McNeil? But realised, different guy.
No, this is just Mr. McNeil.
Mr. McNeil.
Who, as I say, in my head, runs a tent where he sells exotic animals to children. That solves whatever their problem is, you know? Like, if you say go into that tent and you're being bullied at school, he will give you a gorilla that will beat up your bullies. But if you go in and, like, your parents are about to get divorced, he will give you, like a seal that is so adorable that your parents bond again over it and they get back together.
Mr. McNeil and his seal?
Mr. McNeil and his seal? Where do we get to CBeebies? Where do we pitch this? I've got absolute gold.
Do you
right?
think...
Can we get to whoever's made this, like... What's that bloody film that's coming out where, like, is it like Jason Derulo voices a camel or something?
What is that film that's coming out? Let's backtrack.
No,
Jason Derulo voicing a camel.
Yeah, it's got bloody Javier Bardem in it. I don't think it is a camel. It's some animal of some sort. I've seen the trailer a couple of times. It's like, it's a singing, like, anime. It's like they've clearly looked at, like, Lyle Crocodile is called, right?
Like Jamie Lyle.
It's Jamie Lyle, yeah. Where, who is it? No, Shawn Mendes voices a crocodile.
Oh my god.
This is.
I mean, it would have been better if it was Jason Derulo.
So but... it's clearly like after Paddington was a big hit and they did the animated or the live action clip of the Big Red Dog with Jack Whitehall, which has a bit where John Cleese magics a microchip into a dog using magic because that's what cancel culture made him do. He had to do that because of cancel culture.
Shawn Mendes is a crocodile.
And now Shawn Mendes plays a crocodile. And I would have preferred
it if it was Jason Derulo because Shawn Mendes can say anything other than his own name for one.
Javier Bardem has an Oscar and now he's in this. I don't know. I'm very excited. So that's going to be very good. What were we saying?
Mr. McNeil and his seal.
The real seal. He is the real seal. Yep. So
give it the seal of approval.
That's where I think it's going.
Yeah. Do you think Mr. McNeil's like Doctor Who and his first name is impronounceable to the human tongue?
That's exactly it.
So there's like three people in the galaxy who know what it is.
So to everyone else, he's just Mr. McNeil.
He's just Mr. McNeil.
His surname is McNeil.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, his first name is unpronounceable.
Look, it's possible that, like, we don't know that Doctor Who's real surname isn't McNeil. Because, like, if it was, it'd just be really like, underwhelming. And he doesn't want that impression given out, so if he'd be. It humanises him.
Yeah. So, yeah, the game then kicks off. David Campese clears the touch. And I don't want to read my note out. I don't want to read my note out. But I just had a weird observation about David Campese. And I think his shorts are just sticking out weirdly. But, like, okay. It looks super uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I just, you have a moment where you go, like, wait, hold on. You rewind, you go, like, I think it's just his shorts, but I can't be certain.
I mean, you once noticed this with Nigel Owens as well, when he went to the TMO. Then again, he was on screen for a very long time. So... if you're referring to what I think you are, but
Yeah. Maybe for Campese, it's like when he's just woken up and it's just the start of the game. Or maybe it's just him doing a good kick. I don't know. Whatever. Yeah.
Pretty much knows. They happen to everybody. Not everybody. But some
so people. They kick off. Australia kick for touch. Japan kind of fart around for a while and then they get a penalty.
But what I like is the first thing I've written down is Harawa's class, because there's a point where Japan have a line out and they clearly have this pre-planned move where they will crash it up with the forwards and then do some fancy shit. And Hiral just completely ignores it and boots the ball into the Australian 22, and it's absolutely incredible. Like, it's a genuinely brilliant kick, because clearly Australia go, oh, look, they've got all their forwards in midfield. Like, let's just mark all mark that. And David Campese forgets what position he's playing and all of the, like, of everything that's going on, and they just boot it into the backfield. It's incredible.
I'll tell you what, right? And we'll kind of... We might as well cover this now. But Hiral and Katsuki, the number 12...
Yeah,
Their kicking game in this first half really pins Australia back.
Brilliant. Yeah, they are genuinely brilliant.
So, and again, we'll get into how this game goes, right? But if this game was played in kind of modern rugby, right? If it was like, you know, like in like Super Mario Maker, how you can just like switch your level to be played in like new Super Mario Bros. Style or like old Super Mario Bros. Style, right?
Yeah,
if you could do that and just make it in this game into normal, it's not normal rugby, modern rugby.
Normal rugby.
I think Japan win it because they have the smarter tactics, they play better, and Australia win because back in these days, right, if you were talented and you caught the ball, which is the main challenge, you scored. That was kind of it.
Sure. Yeah, right? Yeah.
And they have enough talented players, they have bloody Pap Daddy for one. And Campese and Liner and so on. And all those players are individually talented enough that because they occasionally catch the ball, they automatically score. And that's just how it works.
For reference, there is a point where, talking about Australia, Gordon Bray says on the comms, they've been working hard at this particular exercise all week. And the said particular exercise is catching.
Yep, I believe it. I believe it. But yeah, so Katsuki and Hiral... And them having the kind of 1-2 of, like, they play together at club level and they play together, like, constantly.
Yes.
Like, a kind of, in Japanese rugby, quite an iconic 10-12 combination.
Yeah.
Like, Hiral was known in Japan as Mr. Rugby. And that was kind of the headline when he died a few years ago. He died about 5 years ago.
Right.
Passed away from cancer. And it was kind of referred to as, like, Mr. Rugby has passed away. And, like, there was a section on him in the, I forget the name of the ground, but I saw Georgia play Fiji there in the last World Cup.
Right.
They have a museum on the history of rugby in Japan there. Because it's the town where rugby first came to Japan, where it was a teacher
who
taught in England, brought it over, and it was taught there. And it's kind of seen as like the birthplace of rugby in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a museum in the stadium that when you go in, they have a
I
museum you can walk around. And like they have like a signed shirt from like all of Japan's biggest victories. So like the win over Wales in 2013, the Springboks game in 2015. And I suppose they now have one from that 2019 World Cup that they didn't at the time. As well as all kinds of things. They had a big section on Hiral, I remember at the time.
Oh, wow.
And not putting it together until quite recently, that was who it was that I'd read about.
Oh, that's so good.
And yeah, but like it was very much seen as Katsuki was his kind of, his right-hand man.
Like his partner,
Yeah, his kind of partner in crime. The two of them played as a 10-12, basically
their
entire careers.
That's so good. I love that. So early on, when Hiral makes that kick, Gordon Bray says on the comms, you know, Seiji Hiral, he's been brilliant in this World Cup, and he's going to take the kicks at goal today. And then they get their first penalty, and nuh-uh, Seiji Hiral isn't kicking at goal, because up steps debutant Minoru Okidoi, who... he is pumped.
You can say that again.
Like,
I mean...
For the concept of taking a penalty, regardless of whether it goes over, he is absolutely gassed for that. He's already celebrating, like, putting the ball on the tee.
But, like, Japan in general looks so up for this. Like,
yeah,
the Wallabies
they
have
it.
Turned up as like they've turned up for a game of casual touch or something. You know, they're kind just here
they
to
expect
have
a walker.
Piss
they think
out.
It's a turn-up job. Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
Japan turn up and they all look so energised.
Like, so gassed.
Like, other than Miyamoto, they have no shithouses in their team, right?
Yeah.
All of them are kind of putting in shots and trying to be as, like, hit everyone.
They
cut to their coach a few times, who permanently looks slightly confused. But, like, I don't know what he said to pump them up this much.
No.
Because they are so infused here.
Like, I love Nofumuli Taumafalau being a dick all game. I loved it.
Yeah.
Like, he's been, not timid, I wouldn't say that, because he's quite a big lad, he's quite physical, but like, he's not been these levels of just like being, like pushing people around and stuff. And we will come on to some of the stuff he does and doesn't do. But yeah, just like they're so fired up for it the whole time. And as I say, like Okidoi steps up to take this penalty and he gets the first penalty, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah. So I had written in my notes just like, okay, sure, have a shot, whatever, man. Just because I was like, there's no way he's getting this. Why is he doing this? But yeah, you know what? Fair enough. Because it's 3 minutes in and good on him for having a crack.
Yeah. So,
and then my next note is, oh, fair play in all caps.
Yeah, because it's an absolute belt he gives it. It's like 40 metres. He just in twats it over the goalposts and he goes mental for it. He's like, yeah, I'm amazing. I've scored more points in international rugby than I've played minutes. Yes. And he's absolutely loving it. He's like going up to his teammates like, high five me, high five me. Look, I'm doing great.
How many players have ever been in that situation? Off the top of my head, George North.
It's true.
Anyone else? Yeah.
It's a certain rarity.
Yeah.
But I didn't really focus on whether or not the kick went over because I looked at it and there's this point I started watching it in the office next to you and I started laughing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, why are the goalposts so tall? Let me show you a picture of the goalposts.
I've just checked this. What is going on there?
The goalposts are insanely massive. Like, they go off screen. Like, for the record, right, the screen shows the posts. And around the point where the post would normally end, at a normal set of posts, you can see, like, the horizon, the hills into the distance.
Yeah.
That's about halfway up the screen. At the top of the screen, we don't see the top of the posts. These posts are, like, probably miles into the air.
That's absurd. Do we get a wide shot? How would I not notice this?
That's as wide as they get.
I can see them from my window. Why haven't I noticed them on the game?
I will tweet this image. Okay. So anybody listening can see this. It's absurd how massive
they don't
these
seem to be on the
are.
Other end. They seem to only on one end they've got the goalpost that high. But it's hard to see. It's...
Why would you have one pair of goalposts?
Oh, no, like... no, those upper end are high. They're high. This is bizarre. How did I not pay attention to the goalposts?
The never-ending goalposts.
There are wide shots to the ground where they can't fit the goalposts in.
They go into space.
This is so... What's going on? Why are they so massive? Like the bloody chickens on that farm in Alan Partridge. What's with the goalposts that big?
Like,
what are they?
You can also see that they're slightly uneven because naturally, if they're that massive, they're going to slightly come off balance. But how are they staying up there? Like, you have to dig them clearly really aggressively into the floor. Unless, I guess, if the bottom half of the goalpost beneath the crossbar are the same length and you've just dug that into the floor and they're poking out in England somewhere.
This is so weird. I'm fascinated by these goalposts, man.
Right?
I don't... But what's going on?
I didn't care whether the kick went over. Because, let's be honest, like, the kick going over, like, that's like 80% of the ground is encompassed in that set of posts.
But they're higher than the stands.
They're higher than the horizon, mate.
I don't... There's no shot... I've skimmed through the entire game now. There doesn't need to be any shot that shows just how high they are. Because the only kind of things we get enough perspective is against a white background and it's quite hard to tell. But, oh my god. What?
And like, naturally I looked at it and thought that's got to be some kind of optical illusion. But it's not. Like, you can see like slight markings and slight shadows.
You can see it at different points. Yeah, yeah. Like, you can check any shot of goal and you can see just how high they are from any angle.
I can't believe it.
What is
where
this?
Where is this played? So, this is played in the Concord Oval in Sydney.
Right.
Okay, I've just found something.
Okay.
The Concord Oval is famous for having the tallest goalposts in the Southern Hemisphere. As of mid-2020, the grandstands at the Oval are being demolished. But it is a thing that they have famously tall goalposts. So somebody posted about it to the r/rugbyunion subreddit.
Okay.
If you search Concord Oval goalposts on Google, it's the first result that comes up. And let me tell you, they are that massive. Like, they go above, like, the trees in the background and stuff. Like, they go probably twice the height of those trees in the background.
Yeah.
And they say, the tallest posts in world rugby. They're not used for AFL, which would have made a bit more sense.
So they're used for...
They're purpose-built for the 87 World Cup.
Yeah. So they're now only used for Rugby League, because there's a Rugby League ground that plays there.
Right.
The Tigers play there in Rugby League.
Okay.
They're said to be 70 feet or 21.5 metres high.
70 feet.
Yep.
That's like over 10 times my height. I'm 6'2".
So for reference, right? They're 21.5 metres. Rugby union goalposts are normally 15 metres.
Jesus.
So they're like a half of a goalpost again on top.
Mm. That's
slightly
insane.
More than.
I'm shocked that we've actually managed to get to the bottom of this and that this is real. Like, wow.
Yeah, it's like the post equivalent of Slender Man. Like, there's something just really uncanny about them.
Yeah, like, it's unsettling. Even though it shouldn't be. It's literally
just
sports equipment.
It's just too long. It's like Adam Beard's baby. It's just too long.
Yeah, yeah. It's like Bohemian Rhapsody. There we go.
That's too long. Both the film and the song.
Captain America 2, maybe?
Yeah, sure. Let's go for
that. I'm just trying to think of other things I can make that joke about. There's a Daft Punk song called Too Long. It's too long.
Is there?
Yeah.
Bloody, people always forget, right? Around the world, that song is 10 minutes long.
Yeah, well, it's not. It's like 4 minutes
long. It's like
long,
8 minutes long. Come on.
It is
like
long.
It's 12 minutes long.
It says around the world long.
It's half an hour, man.
Yeah.
It's just,
Lose Yourself to Dance is a very, very long song. For what it is. For a song that has a verse and a chorus and that's it. But it's a,
that's a thing.
Banger, though. Like,
as I say, to go back to Around the World, that song is about 4 words long. And it is 7.5 minutes long.
You had one job.
Three lyrics.
How many words are there in Around the World? How many words is that?
3.
You said it's 4 words long. Where's the fourth word you discovered?
No. I said it's like 4 words long.
Then why didn't you just say it's 3 words long?
I said it's like 4 words
long. Where have you imagined this fourth word that may or may not be in there?
It's around the world.
Oh, a round,
around the world.
Comma, the world. So, like, a thing that is round, meaning the world. Because the world is actually round, contrary to popular belief. Okay, fair enough. Good save. But it's not. Like, anybody with any kind of backbone would have crucified you a bit more for that than I bothered with. But, yeah. Do you like Daft Punk?
Sure, yeah.
You don't have coronavirus.
They're
great.
They do, don't they? Yeah. No, I like Daft Punk. I'm going to say, unfortunately, I was hoping the French translation for Around the World would be 4 words, but it's not. It's 3.
Unlucky.
A tour du monde. So, never mind.
Which is basically a Kraftwerk song. Anyway, back to... back to...
A tour du monde. With the three minutes into the game. Cool.
Yes.
So, Japan somehow knock over this penalty, and you're like, okay, that's cute. Like, Japan get an early lead.
Yeah,
that's good for them. Good for them. And especially when Australia scored their first try. And it is a bit of a bullshit early, like, typical, especially in early rugby, especially in 87-ish. I realise it's not early rugby. The game's like 150 years old at this point. But their try is kind of bollocks. It's kind of like we've got good players, so we'll score 4 points automatically.
Well, I mean, Andrew Slack scores the try, first and foremost.
Yeah.
But we've already established that there are there's three things that are unstoppable in this Rugby World Cup. One of them's John Kerwin, right?
Yeah.
Another one of them is David Campese. And the third one is fullbacks hitting the line. Fullbacks hitting the line are impossible.
There's a fourth one, and it's dogs coming onto the field.
Dogs
right
come onto the field.
You throw it to one of those two players.
That's also true. But fullbacks hitting the line is something where it's just like, it's absolutely insane. Like, it's crazy. Like, it's bullshit. You shouldn't be allowed to do it. They should ban it because it's too good. You just can't defend it, can you? Can you imagine how much defences lose their minds when David Campese hits the line from fullback? And that's what happens on this try. It's like, that's not fair. How can you defend that? Like, what are we supposed to do? It's not fair.
I'm a huge fan of the fact that the camera the kind of TV director cuts into the kind of angle you only ever see on tries.
Mm.
Like, it cuts into an angle you only see when someone's diving over.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of like really close in on him. Because they see him coming into the line and they go like, oh, this is going to be a try, isn't it?
Yeah.
They just cut into Campese in close-up.
And they have no idea how it's going to be a try, but they were right.
No.
And like, yeah. Australia and do these like, funny little fair, switchy moves outside him.
It's but... a... It's a gorgeous try. It's I kind of understand try. It by saying it's yeah. bullshit.
Yeah. No, but it is yeah. bullshit.
Campese just Campese burst the through the line.
Yeah.
Does this kind of like drop off pass and they just inter-flick it between them.
Yeah.
Until it's then...
Like Greg and Cook both do a really good job of like keeping the ball alive and just like making
yeah,
sure...
Yeah, yeah. Cook does a lovely offload.
Yeah, yeah. Where he like lifts it for Greg coming on his outside. Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful.
And then Slack dives
Slack
over.
Slack has a great support line coming back up through the middle. And yeah, dives over, as you say. It's a beautiful first try. Like
it really is.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And like after Japan played all the rugby, it felt like usually I'd go like, oh, why are Australia scoring that try? But actually, it was really good.
It was so good that you don't mind it kind of coming
exactly.
against the Tier 2 nation,
yeah.
the underdog, who are really overperforming and really up for everything. And Japan have a couple of opportunities in those first few minutes where you're kind of like, oh, this could be...
Yeah,
you know, they have one held up over the line around this time. Mm,
they do, yeah.
Which looked like a try to me. Kind of just bollocks.
More or less came from a 50-22 from Kitsuki, I will add.
Excellent kick, that. Brilliant
good, isn't it?
I've got it written down as a 50-22, yeah.
I also enjoy that, like, there's a point where the Australians are throwing into the line out, and I assume it is Mark McBain, who is the hooker, as he's throwing in, shouts the words, hit and drive, before he throws the ball in. It's just like, oh, they're just giving away what they're doing. Which is interesting.
So there's a bit as well, right before this try, I think it actually leads to the knock-on, leads to the scrum, which they score off, where Japan run this utterly gorgeous move where you have Harao and Katsuki kind of interlinking again.
Yeah.
You have them just playing some beautiful rugby, and all the players kind of doing these gorgeous, like, floated, lifted passes, running onto it, lovely angles of running. Then it gets to Miyamoto, who goes, no, I'm just going to be a shithouse and just shoulders someone. And it just sums up this Japanese team so beautifully. Not as well as another moment in late in this half, but it sums up this Japanese team kind of beautifully. That it ends in the knock-on, sure it doesn't work, but it's 14 players being gorgeous and free-flowing and ambitious, and a Miyamoto being a shit.
Yeah. So my favourite bit with Miyamoto was there's a point where he makes like a half break down the right hand flank, and as he catches the ball, he punches Brian Smith in the face and then passes him the ball.
I noticed him passing him the ball. I missed the punch to the face.
Yeah, he does like a handoff, but like with like a fist. So he like hits him like as a handoff, and then to like apologise to him, he just passes him the ball. It's incredible. Like, he beats his man and then just says, no, now you try it. And then he, like, hits him. It's incredible.
He literally beats his man.
Yeah.
But that, like, is true rugby values right there. True rugby values.
Knowing Miyamoto, he just wanted a second pop at him. So he just thought, you have it, so I'm allowed to hit you.
I'm going to say, right, I've got through most of this World Cup without overdoing Nintendo references when there's a player called Miyamoto.
Yeah.
And I'm quite proud of that.
Yeah.
But every now and again, when I hear things like, knowing Miyamoto, obviously he punches him in the face. Where I'm kind of picturing this quite like, very cheery, mild-mannered man who created Mario.
Also, this is an extremely niche reference, but wasn't Sakuraba the name of the guy from The World Ends With You? Who was playing in the second row for Japan? Sakuraba,
maybe.
Yeah. Something like that.
I
recognise the name from somewhere, anyway. There's somebody interesting called Sakuraba. I don't know.
Sakuraba is a familiar name.
Yeah.
But I played the sequel to World's End with You last year when it came out.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's very good. I think there is a Sakuraba in there. No, because he's Neku Sakuraba, yeah.
Is that him? Is that the main character?
I think it is.
Sakuraba, yeah. Okay,
Sakurano or Sakuraba.
Okay.
If not, it's very close to that.
Sure, okay. That would probably be why the name came into my head, and I was like, oh, that sounds familiar. Anyway, so there's a point.
It is Neku Sakuraba. Okay. That is the main character in the World
End With You. And that's his dad playing
the
second round.
You are spot on.
For Japan.
Outstanding work before he produces an emo child for an anime DS game.
Yeah, it's not fictional. I mean, it's fictional, the other one.
Why haven't I put that together? Okay.
I mean, this is the first game he plays in the World Cup, I think, so, yeah. So, there's a point where Australia boot the ball into the air, and it's landing around the Japanese 22, and Nofamuli Taumafalau is in his 22, catches the ball and calls the mark, and gets absolutely nailed after the whistle by Poidovin. And Nofamuli, like, falls over onto his back, looking fuming. Like, you know when somebody falls over and they have that look of just, like, I'm going to knock this guy out as soon as I get back to my feet. Like, mm-hmm. he rushes back to his feet, like, wants to get straight back up and just get his gloves on and ready to go. And then he realises it's Poidevin, who is twice his size. And he then pauses and just taps him on the shoulder. Of just like, nice one, mate. And it's the fastest I've seen someone de-escalate in my life. It's incredible.
Incredible. Absolutely.
Bear in mind, that's a winger on a flanker.
You remember in about 2009-10-ish, there was a Wales-France game where Lee Byrne got taken out in the air. And he gets back up and looks for a fight. Like, he gets up on the touchline, is like, really ready to fight. Then he sees the player he's about to fight is Sebastian Chabal, and he just walks off.
And that's the smartest thing Lee Byrne ever did.
Absolutely, undoubtedly so.
That's phenomenal. I love it. So... anyway, yeah, so Japan then, after Slack's score, Japan don't get disheartened, which is good to see, because a lot of the tier 2 teams straight away just go down as soon as the opposition score a try. But Japan, they didn't. They started just, if anything, they got more ambitious, I would say. There's a point where I have written down, Japan, what the fuck, lads? Because they run a they run a move, which is 10 and 12 do a switch, 12 then jumps into the tackle, then everyone shits themselves and tries to transfer the ball to someone behind them by any means possible, and they get, like,
that's
held up over the line.
It's a great move.
Yeah,
it and, like, so everyone, almost works.
Like, they do that thing where they really accurately drop the ball, and it happens to land in a teammate's hands, like, 4 times.
I think that's not fluke at this point. I think this Japanese team looks really well rehearsed. They look really practiced.
I did note down at one point.
And that's what I really enjoyed about them.
I did note down at one point that I think that Japan, of all of the teams, are the team that are least sort of influenced by ego and, like, wanting to do things for themselves, that, like, putting the team first. And, like, it's a bullshit thing to say because, like, it's international sport. Of course you put the team first. But, like, there's a lot of people in this World Cup, as we've discussed many times, who kick because they want to or for the sake of it or whatever. Like, Japan, there's not really any of
which
that
we'll
going
get
on.
To. Ooh, well, there's one example. There is one example. There's one example.
Do we want to talk about it now?
Should we talk about Japan's tries first?
Okay, sure.
Because they score a couple of really, really lovely ones.
The Katsuki one. Do we want to look at that?
The Katsuki one.
Because, holy shit, that is... that try is about 20, 30 years ahead of its time.
It's absolutely mind-blowing, isn't it? It's gorgeous.
So they run a hit boot play, which for anybody unfamiliar...
a good argument for...
yeah. For anybody unfamiliar, it's the sort of... it's a rugby league style play that is, you see every rugby union team doing several times a game.
Yeah.
So if anyone's unfamiliar with the terminology, you have a hit runner, which is, say you're playing this off 10, just somebody running a hard line, often seen as a dummy runner, but still is an option.
Usually it'd be maybe one of your back row, and then they'd have kind of one of your locks or something, or another forward alongside, as a kind of second option, possibly as a tip on.
Yeah.
They can take another pass.
Yeah, depending on the context whereby you might be doing this. Sometimes you might do it with the backs where the 12's running that line, for example. And then in the boot, you've got probably a winger or just a back generally, somebody who's quicker.
Center.
Yeah, exactly. Who's running out the back into the gap that is being created by the hit runner.
Usually someone who's comfortable passing.
Yes.
There's an example, we kind of talk about it in the Ireland New Zealand video, which should be up by the time people are listening to this. So you can have a look at that. There's an example involving Hugo Keenan in the boot with Josh van der Fleer and James Ryan in the hit, as it were.
And I know we're...
or you have, like, New Zealand running it in the previous test with Rico Ioane in the boot. Like, it's a...
we are slightly over-explaining this because it happens, like, dozens of times per team, per game, in modern rugby at basically any level. But the fact that this was run in 1987 is incredible. We saw a try get disallowed for trying to play this in the 2011 Rugby World Cup's opening match. And they ran this successfully in 1987. And Andrew Slack bought the dummy run all ends up.
Yeah, yeah. It's fantastic, though.
They invent modern rugby. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, it's the thing we talked about in previous episodes, where Japanese rugby is very heavily, especially at this point, and it kind of continues on, built on learning moves.
Yeah, yeah.
On kind of learning moves and executing them like clockwork.
Yeah.
And it's something that Eddie Jones very much tapped
into. It's a rehearsal.
That is part of the kind of, the rugby culture. As you say, like, training's almost like a rehearsal. And it's why Eddie Jones talked about the Japanese team being the most programmable and coachable players he ever worked with.
Yeah.
And because it's just kind of in their blood, like they learn moves. That's part of what you do in rugby as a you know, as a youngster, you learn your line. And I think that feeds into the lack of ego thing, as you say. Like, they all know their role in this.
Yeah, yeah, and they take pride in that. And, like, they run it to perfection as well. Because, like, as I say, in the 2011 tournament, we saw some tries get disallowed, arguably incorrectly for this, because they called it as obstruction. But they run it in a way where it couldn't possibly, even to the worst referees, be called as obstruction. It's like they run it to perfection. It's fantastic, and as you say, like it's like seeing what is now the norm just being invented in front of us. And I know this has been a rugby league play for a long time. I don't know quite how long because we're talking back in the 80s here, but that try is so decades ahead of its time.
Be 80s wise though.
No,
yeah, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. And then the other thing is right. We've then got another try by Katsuki.
Yes.
Then pops up on another gorgeous try.
Oh, it's brilliant, isn't it?
It's absolutely fantastic.
Because, not for Muli or Tamafalau, whichever you want to call him. He goes by both names. It's really confusing. But he had made a mistake beforehand, which we will talk about in a second. But he then...
No, let's cover it. Do it now.
Okay, okay. He makes a mistake, which is he basically makes a grubber kick on Australia's behalf.
So, yeah, shall we? So this is the, as I said earlier, there's a moment in this game that I think sums this Japanese team up perfectly, right? Which is that they have, Harao makes a lovely break. We have Katsuki and Yoshinaga join in. They kind of interlink, they have their forwards offloading.
Yes.
It starts with a really lovely break up the short side, I think, actually. It gets in field, they kind of pass it along, and everything's working really nicely. They've made about 40 metres, and it's really lovely to watch. It's just like really exciting offloading rugby. And then they go for one pass too many. And I think it's Yoshinaga tries to throw the pass. And it does not go to hand. It lands straight in the path of Andrew Slack, who hacks it on. They have several Australians chasing. And as you say, Taumafulau is following back. And he kicks the ball right back to his own goal line. Then has to re...
This is the second time he's done that. We've given him dick. We've both given him dick of the day before for doing that in a previous game.
So he... I think he's trying to put it into touch in this one. You can see he's aiming for the touchline to put it out.
Yes.
But instead, he ends up having to ground it over his own try line.
Very familiar.
From which Steve Toyman at number 8 scores for Australia. Straight drive over try from the scrum.
Yeah. But, as we were alluding to a minute ago, Nofamuli then immediately makes up for his error. Because the next time he gets the ball, he just, like, he morphs into Shane Williams all of a sudden. And he just cuts inside three players with complete ease. Like, and we're not just talking anybody, like he gets the ball and like he cuts inside Matt Burke, he cuts inside Andrew Slack, David Campese, like he cuts inside world class players.
The sheer balance of the way he runs
is fantastic.
It's akin to like the best Argentine wingers.
Yeah.
Which is a feature I always noticed, like Argentine wingers are often the best for sheer balance. But I'd also like look at Kotaro Matsushima as well.
Oh,
as a kind of
that's a great example. Yeah,
like the way he kind of just skims over, like almost over water. You
yeah,
know? he almost looked like if he was running on water, it wouldn't dripple. As
yeah,
he ran over
yeah.
It, the way Taumafulau runs on this try, it's amazing. And then he finds a support in Miyamoto.
Yeah,
who is
it's a really unselfish pass he throws as well.
Punch someone.
Because like playing on the wing, naturally you'd assume he's quite a good finisher. And that he would fancy himself to go the rest of the way. But I think that was it. He knows he's just screwed up, so he really wants to like turn it from a 60% chance to a 70 and then an 100. And he makes exactly the right pass, times it really well.
Yeah. So he gives it to Miyamoto, who then in turn flicks it on, which again, lovely ball for a flanker to be giving.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
They,
really simple.
At this point, weren't often giving those.
Yeah.
But flicks it on, yeah, to Katsuki, who then crashes over, scores.
Good God, what a try.
Yeah.
Is
Katsuki,
fantastic.
Really great support line, times his run on. If you look at it from the kind of wider angles as well, like he arcs round and like makes sure he's getting to the right place.
Yeah.
And does it well ahead of the time, like well ahead of Taumafulau kind of cutting inside.
Yes.
Or like anticipate it as he starts to cut inside. Really, really lovely stuff.
Also,
like, really well taken.
Quickly, a word for Gordon Bray. Brilliant on this game. I really, really enjoyed him because he was really enthusiastic about the Japanese team. And even though they were playing against his team, Australia, he was really knowledgeable about the Japanese players and he was really genuinely backing them and really like buying into their style of play, which I really loved. And when they scored this try, he was really basking in that.
Yeah. Something really lovely and unique. Say this game is being played in Sydney and involves Australia. the crowd are so behind Japan.
Mm. Yeah,
and
yeah.
They are really cheering on every try. And there's a... Should we move on to the moment from the other moment from the first half?
Okay.
So, Japan find themselves with a little overlap, right?
Yeah.
And they start to work it out. And as I think it's Yoshinaga is going to give the pass to, it would be Tamafalau outside it.
Yeah.
Who would be on the end of an overlap and would, if not score, have a very good run into 22. And we've just seen what he can do in the Katsuki try.
Yeah.
In him, like, breaking down his sheer pace, his balance.
If nothing else, you want to see him in open space, don't you? Just to see what happens, yeah. As you say. Yeah.
And he's about to get the ball in open space. Yeah. Right? But one of the Australians, and I'm not sure who it was. I should have named
it. I believe it was Slack.
Okay, it's Slack himself, right? Takes him completely off the ball well before he's near it.
Yep.
And they both go to ground. They're both lying on the ground grappling. The ball comes loose. Hurrell kind of grabs it and throws it up in panic. And who should take it but Matt Burke, who then runs it in.
Yeah.
The length of the field to score.
It's so chaotic because there's so many people falling over in completely different directions. And then Hiral throws that pass and then goes, well, that's fucking dumb, wasn't it? And turns around just like, my bad. Just straight away realising how telegraphed.
The other thing is, like, I think all of them are expecting to come back for the penalty for Slack taking Tamafalau so far off the ball.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, it's the most ridiculous one you've ever seen. Like, there was the, you know, we've seen them happen. Like, Joe Dedwebe got penalised for it. It's quite obvious the other week.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
right, Elias. And, like, they happen.
It's really funny.
They happen.
That, like,
but...
Because, like, in isolation, that Hiral pass is really stupid because he just passes it straight to Matt Burke. As you say, like, in a blind panic. He just kind of goes, I don't know, I just need to give the ball to somebody. And then Matt Burke happens to be the one person who's anywhere near him. Then he realises he's on the opposite team. But, like, the thing is, that's overshadowed by the fact that Tamafalau has just been nailed off the ball. And it's just they're like, hold on, we can blame the referee instead now. I've got an alibi.
But it leads to the crowd not only booing the referee, but booing Australia, and then booing Michael Leiter taking
Michael
the conversion.
Leiter! So, I was really confused by this, because, like, this game's being played in Sydney. It's in Australia.
Yeah.
It's an Australian crowd. Like, why are they... Firstly, why are they booing their team scoring? And secondly, what's Michael Leiter done wrong?
But it's, so it is a horrible decision by the referee.
Sure.
Like, it's an all-time clanger. Like, it's genuinely up there with them allowing the Campesi try against England.
Yeah, yeah,
in terms
yeah.
of...
It's just hilarious. It's just funny.
It is one of the worst refereeing decisions you'll ever see.
Yeah.
It is properly atrocious, right? And I really, really don't know why Mr. McNeil didn't step in and just go, you know what? I've got a peacock that can resolve the situation. But... You then go, this was not Michael Leiter's fault.
No.
Leave Michael Leiter alone.
But... It becomes somewhat clear later on in the game quite where this may have come from, as with about 10 minutes to go, there's a lot of, like, a very loud collective drunk voice in the of the crowd all start singing God Save the Queen.
Okay.
So it's all of the England fans have turned up and, you know, got tickets for whatever other games they can find, so...
It's them obviously
cheering on Japan.
Have they got the same incredulity that they had on the previous game, where, like, some people have travelled over from Wales just to watch the rugby?
And no other reasons. What on earth are they doing?
So, the other thing I have written down around this point is, this is a genuinely good game, WTF.
Yeah, which is enough of a novelty in itself. I've still got quite a few things in the first half, to be fair.
Have you? That's about the end of my notes on the first half.
Yeah, first things first. Markella repeatedly refers to Nofamuli as just Mooley. So clearly he's heard Gordon Bray call him Nofamuli and assumed that his first name is Nofo and his surname is Mooley. Rather than... Nofamuli, in fairness, is his first name and Tamafalau is his surname. So, but it's one of those names where he just goes
by
either one.
Do you want to know a fun fact about him?
Go on.
By the way. He is the uncle of Kalinis Alhalani.
Wow. I mean, I would not put that together. But, I mean, what a player Halani was.
Kind of like... Tongan-descended Japanese people.
Yeah.
Does track, I guess.
Look, it's a great genre of rugby player, I would find.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Nakajima, you've got Ivalu, you know? You've got Moe Akiola, You've got, yeah, Raikkonen Sahalani. What, again, what a player. Like, he didn't,
yeah.
Did he play in 2011? I think he played a little bit, didn't he? Yeah. He played in 2015 as well, didn't he?
I know, I think his last cap was in the warm-ups.
Was it? Right.
He didn't actually make it to the World Cup.
Right, yeah, he got edged out for Hendrick
Tooley.
I
spent a lot of time looking through that Japan era, Eddie Jones.
Yeah.
And I believe he played, in the PNC.
He was a player who, like, outlasted kind of what he should have done, because for a large part of his career, he was just, like, Japan's big fat number eight, who was the one player who could make hard yards. But he adapted his game really, really well when Eddie Jones came in and actually learned to pass and stuff. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was a really good player. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. That's a good nugget of information that he's a relative of his. Yeah, so after Katsuki scores a second try, and Japan are in the lead, I will stress, probably about half an hour into the game, Japan are in the lead by sort of 3-5 points, maybe. First off, after they score that try, Gordon Bray and Mark Ellis start talking about how amazing Japan are. And then they miss the conversion right next to the post. Then they just kind of have this turn of like, oh yeah, they're not that good, are they? But then once the kickoff is made, so Topo Rodriguez, who is playing loosehead for Australia, just randomly, just completely taking the piss, goes for this massive left foot belt into touch on the full. And I absolutely love it because, like, Rodriguez isn't a player we've seen much of other than just doing his job in the tights. Whereas this game, he clearly went into it and thought, I'm going to have fun today. Like, I have to have fun. Yeah. Last game of the group stage, it's serious after this. I'm going to have as much fun as I can now. And, like, we just saw a different animal. It's like he went,
finally my chance to show I want the 10 shirt all along.
Yeah, exactly. It's like when the supply teacher's in and they're not going to feed back to your actual teacher. And you can just mess about as much as you can.
I'd say you close on that. I think it's like the supply teacher who desperately wants to show that actually, he has got a degree in science.
Yeah, I guess so. Either way, something to do with supply teachers.
Yeah, it doesn't work for him, but, he has a go.
But no, I really enjoy Topo Rodriguez just, being funny in this game and not taking it seriously at all, even though his team are behind at that point, and he's still like, no, I'm going to have fun still. Yeah, and none of his players even bollock him. It's great. But speaking of...
He does a lovely, Gavin Henson style, flip, hangs the ball in the
air. Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's great. So speaking of bollockings, there's a point, and I have it written down, it's 33 minutes and 30 seconds in, where you can hear Michael Lynam starting to bollock Brian Smith on the ref mic.
Really?
So Brian Smith is, he's at the back of a mall where the forwards are rumbling it forward. And you can hear on the ref mic, I want it now, Smithy. Wake up, Smithy. Wake up. Wake up, Smithy. And then you can hear something else, Smithy, but I couldn't quite make out what.
Are you sure that is Michael Lynam, not Eddie Jones?
Either one.
Somewhere in the crowd.
When he says, I want it now, he's on about the Australia job.
Yeah. Give it to me.
Yeah.
So, Australia go in only 16-13 ahead, having just pulled the lead back thanks to that bullshit try by Matt Burke.
Yes.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So, we've done the first half.
Yes.
Then there is a slightly difficult part to discuss. And do you know what I'm on about?
No.
Did you watch the halftime coverage?
No, I skimmed through it.
Well, it's just as well. Because...
Okay.
We're slightly skipping ahead early to Dick of the Day territory, but I'm about to play you.
Oh, no.
Mark Keller.
Okay.
Last time he was on comms, he said something quite racist. This time, he said this.
Jesus.
Duncan, we've got a minute and a half before they kick off. Duncan? Can I claim compo for the cauliflower ears wearing these things all day? Okay, I feel like I've got them. Demand compo. Can I join the union? Which union can I join? Besides the Australian Rugby Union.
So...
I feel like I missed that.
Basically... It's just really shit banter that he's making. Saying, can I claim compensation? Right. Saying, because I'll have cauliflower having to wear these headphones all day, is what he's saying. Which is just, you know, shit banter. It's just boring, whatever. You know, it doesn't But essentially the vibe is, he doesn't realise his mic's still on, or his mic's back on from half time, and he's trying to make shit banter with the producers. But I've only covered half of it. Because it gets a lot worse, Mark Ella's chat... not knowing he's back on air.
Okay.
So, I'm about to play you another clip, which comes immediately after that, where Gordon Bray realises they're back live again and tries to get them back on track. Mark Heller, however, does not.
Oh, Jesus.
He's a fabulous player. Quite actually, she's a glamorous sort down there. Hmm? Glamour.
A brunette.
I am. I'd like to work on her.
Dressed up as lamb, mate.
Mm. And she loves me too. Yeah, I don't come that easy though.
Oh?
Yeah, you have to work hard to get me.
He's blaming the TV people.
There's a few down there that you can have then.
Jesus Christ!
Beg your pardon? How are you, boys?
Here's the thing, though, right? The moment this podcast goes up, suddenly there's going to be a flurry of Google activity, as somewhere, London Irish Google is Mark Heller still playing? Can we sign him?
Yep. So. Mark Heller was just being basically a misogynist piece of shit on Mike.
Yep. Enormously so.
Yep.
That was horrible.
Yep.
That was really quite horrible.
Really difficult to listen to. And, like, as I say, he made
Gordon Bray is so uncomfortable there as well.
He hates it. He hates it. And, like, there's clearly, like, you could just sense an aura of Gordon Bray thinking, like, oh my god, I've got to spend 40 more minutes with this asshole.
Yeah.
Because there's a point at first when Mark Heller... presumably not realising he's back on air, says, like, oh yeah, she's a sort down there. And Gordon Bray just kind of goes, wait, what? And then Mark Heller does this stupid little wolf whistle, which on its own makes him a fucking idiot. And then Gordon Bray then goes, like, what, the brunette? And kind of thinks, do I humour this? Then goes, because, you know, I want to have this, you know, conversation with someone on air. It's what I'm paid to do. And then when Mark Heller just goes on, Gordon Bray just is basically having to say, shut up, stop talking, by not talking back. And then Mark Heller just goes on this mad, lengthy monologue, this soliloquy about how good-looking he is.
Yeah, and about, oh, she'll have to do well to get with... like, have you seen Mark Heller?
Yeah, right?
He looks like an extra from Goodfellas. Like, it's genuinely quite. And, like, I've been in that situation that Gordon Bray's in there.
Yeah,
you know, like, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have.
Yeah,
like, where you've been in that situation where someone says something really uncomfortable and it's like,
yeah,
you know, hey, don't you think so? Hey. I don't
want to be part of this conversation.
No,
let alone on live television. Like.
Yeah, exactly. I've never had to do it on live television. I've had to do it, like, plenty at both rugby situations and, like...
sure.
Having done comedy, it's... live comedy is a surprisingly... well, I suppose not surprisingly, because it's incredibly male-dominated. But it's a very uncomfortably, often like that, environment.
Yeah.
And I won't name the comedian. There's a comedian who's reasonably well-known, who I opened for once, who spent the entire night then... being incredibly leery to me, and because it was someone who, I don't know, and I thought about that a lot, of like, I wish I'd said something then, I wish I'd done stuff, and I'd be more like, because I think, I don't know,
Yeah, so I've been in that kind of situation that Gordon Brazen there quite a lot, and it's something you've got to... Also, it was the 80s, you know, like there is far more that kind of thing people got away with far more.
Yeah, yeah, they did. They did, but...
Oh, God, I hate it.
It's awful. And, like, not long after that, there's, like, a few more comments Mark Ellerich made generally, and I was like, my God, he has Dick of the Day sewn up.
Yeah.
Like, for several reasons, but... Yeah, basically, long story short, as I say, that one comment of, oh yeah, all the Japanese people look the same. Like, I get that it was a different era and that's a one-off. But actually, listening to that, I think, no, Mark Heller, you're a wanker.
Yeah, just like treating... And was it a member of the crowd or like a production
It was
assistant?
A member of the crowd.
That was the impression I got.
I
was like, okay, it was the crowd rather than
I believe
a production person.
Or at least, I don't know. I believe so, but I could, like, the person they're on about isn't on television, like, isn't on screen at any point. So,
no,
can't really tell.
It's just
just nasty. Disgusting, isn't it?
It's just treating someone as just a piece of meat. I hate it.
Yeah.
And not like a piece of meat in the Goodfellas way, like he should be doing.
Yeah.
Like put in the freezer or something.
Yeah. Like, when Austin Healey makes comments about, oh yeah, look at me, I'm really good. Like, it's a character, it's a joke. Whereas he actually thinks the world of himself.
Yeah, as you said, there's a lot in those kind of comments about, oh, she needs to do well to get with me. It's like,
shut up. Grow up.
Shut up, Markella. Grow up. Yeah.
Then Gordon Brazen,
move on?
After that goes... Yeah. Anyway, like, back to the rugby. You know, let's stop thirsting over women on live television. Thank you very much. Let's talk about the game. And so they do. Miyamoto gets clotheslined. Play on.
Yep.
He did have it coming, though, let's be honest.
Oh, he does a beautiful deliberate knock-on as well, start of the half.
Oh, yes, he does. Yes, he does.
Yeah, lovely stuff. Just like properly slapping the ball forwards. No subtlety whatsoever. Gorgeous stuff. That one sound like Markella, Jesus.
There's a point where...
Yeah, lovely.
There's a point where Matt Burke stitches Campo up and throws him like a horrid hospital pass inside zone 22. It's great.
Yeah, and tell you what, Krasuki murders
him. He does! He goes like, this is my one opportunity to put a massive shot on this knob David Campese. Let's do it.
There's an actual death to be reported.
Yeah.
R.I.P. David Campese. He died right before he broke the all-time try record.
Yeah. Which we will come on to. So, do we want to talk about the next try or something else? I'll give you the choice.
Which one's the next try?
We'll talk about the next try. I have it in my notes as, wait, what? Grigg scored? Because they keep re-showing in slow motion this forward pass that was given to Campo in midfield, which was a forward pass, and they're like discussing it. And then you can just hear Gordon Brown commentator going, oh, and Nick Grigg's in.
Nick Grigg?
No,
Nick Grigg.
Peter
Nick
Grigg.
Nick Grigg's in.
Yeah.
Nick Grigg did it.
Nick Grigg did it pre-birth.
When was Nick Grigg born?
Probably a couple of years later than this.
Nick Grigg was born in 1992.
Yep. Nick Grigg, age minus five, scored in the Rugby
interesting
World Cup.
Fact here. Nick Grigg is the first person to score in the Rugby World Cup before being born.
Yeah. It's very impressive. So yeah, Nick Grigg comes up on the end. And that's why I was so confused. Because he hadn't been conceptualised yet. None of it.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, this concept starts running down the wing. And I don't know how they even got the ball to him. And even if it was Peter Grigg, the winger, I wouldn't have known how they got it to him. Because literally the camera just flashes back and Grigg is there just running down the wing.
Yeah. And I just have Grigg try from nowhere written in my notes and I think that sums it up.
Yeah, it does. It's from literally nowhere. I also write that Gordon Bray says that might be the one that bakes the camel's back, which is a really good phrase. Bakes the camel's back, not breaks it.
Okay, another interesting point shortly after this, right?
Yes.
Australia get penalised for taking a man without the ball out. And you're like, oh, now you can't do that.
Yeah. It's one
but
of those
now
where
Mr. McNeil steps in.
If you're the ref, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, right?
Yeah.
It is funny, though. It is funny. Then there was the try where Australia scored and I didn't even realise because it was literally just like a bad offload and then a dude flips over. Great, well done.
Yeah, just right in the corner.
Yeah. I don't even know who scored that try. I don't have a clue. But
one of us should have been making notes.
Yeah, we should have. We should really try that in future.
I think it's Slack again. I think it's Slack.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. So, there is a point where Australia have a line out in their own half. And as they're setting up to throw it in, you can hear a kid in the crowd And we've had run-ins with these before. A kid in the crowd shouts, "Don't kick it!" as Australia are packing down. Which makes me think this kid is the arch rival of the super boot hating devil child who was at the Fiji game before the other week.
I was thinking, that's fascinating, because that grew up to be one of those people that now sits in pubs and goes, "Don't know why the box cooks so often.
Yeah.
They're cooking berserkly,
I mean,
aren't they?"
That too.
Like, we're seeing his origin story. It's like an origins movie for that guy.
That too, but also, this kid's on Superboot's side, I would imagine. This kid is...
True.
You know, because that Superboot was in New Zealand. This one is in Australia. So these kids are completely separate. And this one is not in the favour of, "Just kick it," as that stupid idiot kid said at that point. No, 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 none of that. This kid is the reverse of that. He is the antithesis of that child. I'm on his side. I know what you're thinking.
Right?
I know what you're thinking.
Sure, okay, they'll just have an epic battle and that'd be fine.
Yeah, yeah.
So, we then have a far more exciting kick.
Oh,
right?
Yes,
and I
want to
talk about this kick. I just want to talk about this kick. Because David Campese, in his own 22, under some pressure, does a lovely clearance. Put it up
he
to
does.
About halfway.
Yeah, yeah.
Thinks, "We're fine. We're grand here. I have cleared the line. I may get another appearance in my shorts as a result."
Yes.
However, what he is not counting on is the one, the only, the debutant, Minoru Odoki.
Yes.
And he takes the ball. He looks in field. He has Mukai, the fullback, calling for it, wanting the ball. And he goes, "You know what?
Not a fucking
you know what?
Chance.
I fancy a crack." And he turns side on and he lines up the most ambitious, pointless and glorious drop goal you will ever see.
I've never seen someone reject a pass opportunity so hard. I'm just like, if you think you're receiving this from me, you've got something else coming, son.
I have written in my notes, hell yeah, completely pointless winger drop goal. The coach looks bemused.
That's it. Because the fact is, he utterly shatters the drop goal. He nails it.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It's unbelievable. It's one of the best drop goals you'll ever see.
Yeah, it goes
like,
through
it
those never-ending posts. Like, you wouldn't believe.
You remember 2009 when Jonathan Sexton first broke through and he kicked that incredible drop goal from the corner of the pitch in the semi-final? Yeah, yeah, yeah. It reminds me of that. Like, it's very similar to that.
Sure.
Except, that wasn't a decisive moment in a huge game. It was a drop goal to put Japan only 3 points behind. No. Actually, no. They were 10 points behind at this point.
Yeah, they were, yeah.
Yeah. To put them only 2 scores behind.
Sure, yeah, yeah, yeah. It was completely for a flex. And I was so here for it. Like,
absolutely.
I absolutely loved the fact he got it. Because, like, the fact that he turned the thing down, it was like, purely just like, yeah, well, I've, like, big balls confidence type call. And also, like, he went into the game thinking, like, okay, here's a list of things I'm going to do when I get on there. I'm going to nail a 40-meter kick, and I'm going to go for a drop goal, like, whenever the opportunity strikes. And he did. He nailed it. Like, I have written down in here, in my notes, Japan winger nails 45-meter drop goal for a pure flex. And because I wrote this in my notes on my iPhone, when I wrote the word nails, it prompted me to put the emoji in there. So I tapped it, just like the emoji of somebody painting
Brilliant.
Their nails. And it felt appropriate for that drop goal.
Absolutely, absolutely so. And I love the shot of the coach afterwards, who has this kind of, like, bemused but proud look on his face. Like he's watching his son play, like, lower leagues, like, Sunday league football.
Yeah.
And he's just scored the winning goal but shat himself in the process. Like, that's the look he has on his face. Of, like, I should be proud, but...
There's also... So, when he catches the ball, Gordon Bray says, like, oh, yeah, Okadoi goes to the drop goal. Oh, what a drop goal by Okadoi. Whatever. And then when he throws over to Mark Heller to, like, describe the drop goal, Mark Heller then goes, yeah, I'm not sure which player it was. It might have been Harau, actually. It might have been Okadoi. It might have been Mukai. In fact, it could have been Kitsuki. In fact, no, it was Okadoi. It's like, yeah, Gordon Bray literally just told you that, you idiot.
Yeah. But then, to be fair, the camera does cut to Harau, just assuming it was the time.
Oh, really? But still, just like, Gordon Bray was right. Like, he was paying attention, man. Like, oh. Anyway, shut up, Mark Heller. David Campese scores.
There's a great moment between there, like, just before David Campese's try, where, like, right in the lead-up, where Michael Leiner hangs a massive bomb in the air, and the Japanese fullback is positioned perfectly under it, and Mackay takes the catch perfectly. Like, it's brilliant, like, high ball
work.
But I have written in my notes, call the mark, you twit.
Yes.
Because instead, he gets flattened, lose the ball, Australia just spread it wide, and Campo scores in the corner.
Yeah, it's literally just like, he caught the ball, and then he looked up and just goes, shit. As he has, yeah, like, this, like, four onrushing bulls running towards him, like some kind of like standoff, and he just gets absolutely trampled on. It's incredible. Like, and the thing is, like, by the time Campos scored, other Japanese players are just about returning to their half. Like, he looks up and then he goes, oh no, I've made a huge mistake.
Just call the mark,
you twit.
You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, Campos so scores Campesi the equaling try on the world record.
His 24th try, which is, of course, yeah, the equaling try equals Ian Smith's record for most tries by an international
Indeed.
Rugby union player.
Indeed.
Now, here's the interesting thing about this, right? Is that David Campese here scoring his 24th try, right, of 64. Like, he absolutely shatters that record. Like, when you look at the all-time try scorers,
that's
right,
insane. This, like,
they're all fairly close. Then you see Camp, like, but at the time, the record was 24, and Campese scores 64.
That's insane. That's, like, near enough three times that.
Yeah, like, it is the Simon Poddevin's Wikipedia page of try scorers.
It really is. It's that's insane. Like, nobody is ever in doubt about that. People sometimes look at Daisuke Ohata at the top of the records and kind of, they don't count it. They say, like, Campo is really the top try scorer because Ohata played a lot of his tests against, like, Hong Kong and, like, developing Asian rugby nations. So people kind of discredit it. I don't believe in that. I think that it's a test match nonetheless. And if you're good enough to score all of those tries, it counts, right? And Ohata
also
generally,
like,
was a great player and did score against a lot of tier one nations as well.
Yeah,
which people
you
forget.
Look at,
he scored against the All Blacks,
exactly,
didn't he? Like,
you look at Ohata's record against tier one nations and it's almost a try again.
Yeah.
Like,
I'll tell you what,
look at his tries against Scotland and so on, and he's excellent.
He's a player I can't wait to touch on in this series.
Yeah,
because I've never seen him play a full game. I've seen watched his highlights and he looks absolutely brilliant. I can't wait to start watching him in whatever World Cups he plays in, 03 and 99, maybe?
Yeah. He got injured. He missed the 2007 World Cup injury.
Right, yeah. But upstepped Onozawa at that point, so, you know. But yes, anyway, back on track. Campo scores that try.
Yeah, Campese, right before absolutely shattering the world record. Like, to a level
that's incredible.
That no one will ever see again.
Yeah.
Like, no one will ever break a world record as desperately as Campese.
Yeah.
You know, he only equals it in this game, and maybe he breaks it as we go on. But maybe we'll see that over the course of the tournament.
Yes.
He then, like, shortly afterwards, finds himself on the outside again and gives a really beautiful pass over his head to Grigg.
It's delicious.
He steams down the wing, chips, and Katsuki gets into position to cover and kick it and clear it. Like, he is
my guy. Yeah.
Like, I don't think we've done justice to just how good
he is.
Eiji Katsuki's been.
He is Peter Omani-ing the hell out of this game.
Yes. Absolutely is.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. There's a couple of, actually, once Campo has his try, there's a couple of brilliant passes he puts in.
Yeah.
Backhanded offloads, like, over the head, like, short pop passes. Oh, it's delightful to watch. There's a point where I have, Harao does what I can only describe as a cheat code touch finder, where it just feels like there's a glitch that's, like, doubled the trajectory of the flight of his ball, and it goes miles.
That boy has a heck of a boot.
He does. He does.
For the ear as well, hell of a boot on him.
And Japan get another penalty, and they go to 19-30 with 67 minutes played. Really good scoreline, that is.
They're starting to get in touch.
Yeah.
There's another moment, just a wrap just before the penalty, which is one of my favourite bits of the game, where there's an incident by the ruck. The referee has awarded the penalty to Australia.
Yes.
In their own 22, in the opposition 22, in the Japanese 22. And there's a little scuffle at the bottom of a ruck.
Mm.
And one of the Australians is then, like, rolling on top of a Japanese player.
Basically,
like, coming around to punch him. And the referee grabs him by the legs in order to stop him punching him.
I didn't see that!
Like, like, as he kind of tips up, like, he's on the ground, like, and he kind of tips over, like, to swing his whole body weight behind it. The referee grabs him by the leg, and he kind of goes, uh-oh, the teacher's caught me, and doesn't throw the punch.
That's incredible. I didn't spot that. It makes you think, like, you think of, like, the world-class maul defenders, like Adam Beard, Tige Byrne, Sam Whitelock. If one of them went into refereeing, Franco Mostert, like, the things they could do to prevent people doing side entries... Incredible.
Yeah, I mean, and it'd be great if Adam Beard went into refereeing, because he's the only one that could see if the ball went over those posts.
Yeah, it's true, it's true. He should be a touch judge so he could just catch it behind.
Where he might accidentally charge it down, might hit him in the face.
Yeah.
Like Alan Davis charge down style. Yeah, I mean, that was great. He then reverses the penalty against Australia, so Japan get it.
Yeah, true.
But then, of course, because it's how this worked, Japan, I think, win about one line out all game.
Yeah, they were shit at the set piece.
Like, they're not interested in that. Like, and it's part of why I think their kicking game is so important and why they're so good.
Yeah, it's true.
Because they're losing the ball instantly, so they might as well play
It's
territory.
One thing I love is, like, all that, like, their front row, second row, they all played well. They just didn't do anything at the set piece. They just didn't bother.
No. They're just not interested at all. They do, however, the one line, basically the one line that they do win, and, like, Mark Keller goes nuts for, like, how important a line-out win it is.
Yeah.
Again, not too long after this, as that score is starting to creep down, just outside the 22, Miyamoto himself, our hero, our boy, wins the ball at the back of a line out, brings it in, they spin it round a bit, they look like they're going to form a maul, when actually they spin it out, and the forwards just begin offloading down the short side, and it's some lovely interplay that results in the ball getting to Toshiyuki Fujita, the hooker, who looks up, and he has three men to beat. He steps the first one, he fades around the second one, and he crashes through the third tackle to score.
Good God, what a finish that is. Like,
what
I just
finish
like,
for us.
Yes, Fujita! Like, I loved that try, especially because, like, they nearly scored, like, a brilliant, like, half-length of the field try a minute earlier, and they were just put into touch. It was a knock-on from Ikuta, the scrum half, like, stopped it at the last second. And then the fact they won the ball back... and managed to score that try through Fujita, who really earned it, because he's been brilliant all World Cup.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was great that we could see that side of him, see it was great finish from him. Yeah, as you say, to put them back in real contention of nicking the game with less than 10 minutes to go.
Yeah. So, if they nailed this conversion, a converted try would have won the game for them.
Yeah, yeah.
And Hurrell misses the conversion narrowly,
yeah.
But it's a pretty good attempt.
It's a bloody good attempt, yeah. The other thing...
Yeah.
So, just before this try happened... I have written down, as I say in my notes, mate, Mark Keller has dick of the day sewn up so hard because he's just chatting so much shit. And then straight afterwards, I just said, okay, but David Campese did just drop the ball over the try line about to score the world record try, so... And then straight
Fair
afterwards,
point.
It was like, and the crowd are singing God Save the Queen, pricks. So,
speaking of things David Campese does that are dick of the day contenders, there's a bit where he does a goose step round someone, a goose step round a second one, and kicks out on the full, which I'm pretty sure what people think Marcus Smith does.
Yeah, literally. It was like the two gooseies were absolutely like outstanding.
Yeah,
It was literally peak David Campese doing them. So that phrase doesn't exactly work, but it's his trademark.
What are we going to do when we get to 95? We have to talk about things being Jonah Lomu-esque.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the bit in Squid and the Whale when Jesse Eisenberg describes the metamorphosis as being Kafka-esque.
Nice.
Because he hasn't read it and he's trying to sound clever.
Yeah, I rate that. That's what people should do when watching this podcast, but without commentary. And they're like, oh, that fullback who's coming to replace Andrew Leeds, who might be Andrew Leeds. He looks like Campese. There's a point where, as well, Hiral puts a kick in and Gordon Bray says, that's a sensible kick that's going out on the full.
Yes!
Like, he has to pull it back when he realises it's not a smart kick after it's hit his boot. And I sympathise, because the amount of times that anybody listening to this
will watch
rugby and go, oh yeah, good kick. Oh, never mind.
Yeah, great option. Oh,
yeah, exactly. And stuff like that happens. And the difference is, we're not on live television when we say that. So I do sympathise with Gordon Bray in that, but it was a good comedy moment nonetheless.
Other moment I love, this is just one of my favourite moments, and it's kind of nothing comes of it, but there's an absolute, one of the most insane scrums I've ever seen,
okay.
Where the ball is fair, it's an Australia put in, he feeds the ball into the middle, and the scrum wheels entirely until, without shoving it, it ends up at the Japanese number 8's feet. So he just goes, all right. He picks it up and just tries to offload it to his scrum half. But because the scrum's wheeled so badly, the entire Australian back row is stuck between him and his 9 now. So he just offloads it.
Post it over the top of both packs.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, we want this. So here it is.
He tries, and Australian number 8's just like, okay, just regathers it and runs. And like the scrum, the two front rows wheel so badly that there's two back rows end up in the same place.
Yeah.
And the referee goes, play on.
Because again, this happened the other week where the scrum wheeled like 180 degrees and the referee didn't know the protocol because there wasn't really one. It was just kind of like, oh, is everyone onside? Is there an offside line? What is that? And just, but this one was 10 times funnier because, as you say, the back rows were all basically hugging each other.
Yeah, they just end up together. You've kind of got the back rows separate off from the front rows, and they just kind of have like a little one-on-one.
The teams put their differences aside. They're like, we've just got to make it through this now. We've just got to figure something out.
Like Dan Evans.
Yes.
So that's a niche reference for Welsh rugby Twitter people.
It is indeed.
So I think, does this bring us through the game?
I think it does, because there's a try we didn't see, and that is Australia's own fault. Should have scored it earlier on, so it didn't happen.
Down to that.
Yeah. So
and so. That brings us through the pool stage, and it also brings us through Japan's World Cup.
It does indeed.
And therefore, on to the Japanese leaving party.
Hell yeah.
And, in particular, the song Tawa Nai by the Gospelers.
Okay, I'm so excited for this.
Into it so far, this screams Japanese legend prop forward.
Yeah. Second row forward. Oh, wait, did you say he played prop as well? Yeah.
He's a prop who played second row, yeah.
Well, this bangs.
So these are initial lyrics in England. Girl, was that you here? I can't live, I can't sleep, I can't breathe without you. Woo, I need you, I need to be close to have you all. I want to be where you are, let me love you. Ooh, woo, woo. And then the rest of the lyrics in Japanese.
And that's about Toshiki Hayashi, the second row for Japan in this game.
Apparently.
Okay, fair enough.
I will admit, they weren't
the lyrics I was expecting.
Okay, so I've translated the lyrics into English. I'm going to skim through them quickly.
Yes.
I wish I could see the thread that connects the two. I still remember the smile with my eyes closed. If it has no shape, it must be broken. That's profound.
The warmth that
I hugged remains. I want to be your wind and wrap everything up. Does that mean like tackling?
Yeah, it must do.
Beyond the distant time is forever. From here, Awu, I will never leave. I swore to hug each other. I heard the sound of rain last night. Oh. I want to be the wind and wrap everything up. The voice that echoes in her heart is her until the time stops forever.
I mean, that's nice, isn't it? I still don't see how it's about Hayashi, but it's a nice song.
But, like, good on them for dedicating their beautiful ballad to a
what
Japanese
a lovely
type
song.
Forward.
Yeah. So, Japanese leaving party. God, I'm going to miss them, you know? Like,
I am.
A lot of these tier 2 nations, we've kind of, like, skimmed over and just gone, oh, they're fine, whatever, I don't really care, to be honest. But, like, Japan were really good. I really liked them.
Japan,
and, like, it was a real blueprint for what they're going to go on to be, you know,
absolutely.
Brick by brick, World Cup by World Cup.
We've talked about this quite a lot over the episodes on them.
Yeah.
But there is the clearest blueprint of what they will become of any nation in this World Cup. Other than maybe the All Blacks, because they're just better than everyone else.
Sure.
And they'll score lots of tries, similar to the kind of 2011-2015 teams.
Yeah.
But there's a clear blueprint of the style of play, of what they're eventually going to become, you know, in the last 10 years.
This song is really nice. Carry on.
It's lovely, isn't it? Yeah. So, yeah, that's, I think, they're a really, really fun team as well.
Mm.
They've got a clear style of play, a clear game plan.
Yeah.
They've clearly got a coach who's thought
like
about the
game. Like an ethos about rugby, yeah. Which still stands today, which is insane. They have such a national identity in terms of the sport, and that's so rare. Like, it's usually just a cliche that lasts a few years, but they genuinely do, and I love that. It's so unique. It's brilliant.
They're probably the team going out in the pool stage that I'm going to miss most.
Me too, yeah. In terms of players, I mean, Seiji Hirao has been fantastic, hasn't he? And as you mentioned beforehand, like Matsuo and Kitsuki, also brilliant. Miyamoto, we have both grown fond of.
Big fan of both Miyamoto and Fujita.
Fujita's
kind
great.
Of,
Again,
he is just a prototype Horrier.
Shota Horrier before Shota Horrier existed. God, they've got so many brilliant players. I've loved Hayashi himself. Hayashi himself has been fantastic as skipper. Yeah, I've loved Japan in this. They've been really good. And my dick of the tournament for them is Sean Webb.
Yep, hard to argue too far. Hard to argue too much.
Because he did that kick against France in 2011.
Tauber Flau has a couple of dickish moments, but I feel it's harsh to call him. He's probably had the most dick of the day moments, but it's harsh to call him that because he has been quite fun to watch.
That's true, actually.
Like, he's entertaining.
And he was really good in this game as well.
Whereas if I'm nominating one player as their player of the tournament, I am going Horao.
Yeah.
As I love Fujita, love Miyamoto. I think Katsuki actually, quite on the quiet until this game, has been very good.
Mm.
And it really steps up into his own here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's such a good, fun team.
Mm.
But Horao, to me, stands out as like absolute class. Probably next to Grant Fox, the best 10 in the tournament in the pool stages for me.
Yeah, he's been excellent.
Really elevates everything Japan have done. Players come away like with so much respect for earned.
Sure. Yeah. I totally get that. Should we move on to Man of the Match and Dick of the Day from this game then?
Let's.
I think we should start with Man of the Match. In fact, let's start with the Dick of the Day because it's Mark Eller.
Okay. It's Mark Eller. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was trying to work out because like the referee grabbing a player's leg so they can't have a fight feels like a Dick of the Day thing. As does the Grigg try. Not the Grigg try, the Burke try.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know what? I'm not going to do that.
There's a point where an Australian uses the R slur to call a move.
What?
Which is quite horrible. That they have a call. It's like right at the end of the game when they're setting a scrum. And they call the R word Island is the name of one of their moves, which is...
That's quite horrible.
Quite horrible. I assume that was around that Mark Eller named that move when he was playing.
Yeah.
And that stuck around. Anyway, Mark Eller's dick of the day, unquestionably.
Yep. For both of us. Yeah.
Man of the match.
See.
Difficult one.
I don't think it is.
Go on.
I'm absolutely nailed on my dick on my man of the
go
match.
Go on.
I have no doubts at all. This is one of the clearest decisions I've had all time.
Okay.
Like, I know exactly who it is.
Go on.
It's Aiji Katsuki.
Okay. I love that.
I think he was
brilliant. And he was the first name I've written
everywhere.
Down. Yeah.
Yeah. He scores two tries, both of which really great, smart tries. His
defends
kicking game
brilliantly.
Is excellent.
Yeah, he does.
Defends really well. His work rate is excellent. You look at him covering back and covering a chip over which Campese's chasing and he beats him
to
it. Yeah. Yeah, kicks brilliantly. I think was a great foil for Horao. Like, bought him so much time.
Yeah.
I thought Katsuki was brilliant.
Yeah, he was.
Like, he is absolutely nailed on one of the furthest away man of the matches I've had to give out this tournament.
Yeah,
so
I love that.
I go, Aiji Katsuki is my player of the match.
I love that. As I said, he was the first name I'd written down. I had more Japanese players written down than Australians.
Yeah.
I had not familiar written down just for fun. I think Andrew Slack was absolutely fantastic for Australia.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
He's somebody that I... And also, the whole thing of him giving the captaincy to Poidevin really boosts that for me from just a rugby values perspective. I think, as much as you are completely correct about Katsuki, I think for sheer poetry, I'm going to give Man of the Match to Seiji Hirao.
Okay.
Because I think he was utterly fantastic. He kicked brilliantly and was just everywhere in the game. And I loved him. I think it's good that they each get a Man of the Match thing as their partnership.
Yeah. Yeah, I can completely get beyond that.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. So, that brings us through to the end of the pool stage. We made it.
We did it. We made it. Unbelievable. And this episode's like coming up on 2 hours. It's incredible.
I don't know. To be fair, it's the first time we've had a good game to talk about. I don't blame us getting carried away.
It's true.
Plus, we had to talk about like notebooks in Worcester for a bit.
You know?
Sometimes you just got
to
do
really
that.
Really important topic to address.
So, please join us next week when we move on to the knockouts. We're getting so close to the end of this tournament.
Yes, quarterfinals.
Yeah, the first quarterfinal as the home team, New Zealand, take on Scotland.
Oh, I wonder which way that one's going to go.
Who could ever know? Who could ever know which way that game is going to turn out?
New Zealand, one of two good teams thus far in the tournament, against Scotland, who have been fine.
Sorry, who's the second good team?
France.
Okay. Okay, I'll give you that. It's a bit kind, but... So, we will see you then for New Zealand against Scotland. See you very soon. Good night.
Goodbye. I've not cut this one off midway through, despite the fact the game did.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.